All right. Is it okay? Okay. The committee will come to order, and thanks everybody for coming today. We have a pretty full agenda that we'd like to move through, a variety of different and somewhat connected issues, but there are things that were left over from the session that we wanted to make sure that we have some time that we took some time to spend on them. Just a little bit of update. We have done other interim work so far since the session ended. We took a tour of hospitals, and some of you joined us at certain locations, and some made it all the way through, I guess. I think President Murphy made it all the way through, and which was really helpful. And then we have some small groups that are working on a variety of issues, and you'll be hearing more about that as the fall proceeds, I guess. But we're going to go to about 4 p.m. today, and so we're going to try to keep it moving along, but we do want to have enough time to have a good hearing on each of the issues before us. And so I think we'll just... Oh, expense forms are in your folders for members, and you can just turn them into Kate at the end of the meeting. So, Representative Hortman, are you going to kick off the first... All right, there we go. On complex regional pain syndrome education. And I think Representative Saylor is also... It's up to you, however you guys want to coordinate the presentation. Okay, President Hortman, lead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Late in the session, I introduced a bill, House File 2386, which would create some public education surrounding complex regional pain syndrome. And I was asked to introduce the legislation by my constituents, Dan and Kathy Mako. Their daughter, Olivia, swims with my kids on the swim team. That's how we knew each other. So I will just introduce Dan Mako to you to explain the bill and why we introduced it.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just say your name again for the record and then go ahead. Thanks.
Dan Mako. My wife, Kathy, and I are here today supporting our daughter, Tracy Mako, and the entire complex regional pain syndrome, formerly known as reflex sympathetic dystrophy community. Our daughter, Tracy, was diagnosed with CRPS at the age of 12. Tracy was always an active, positive young girl. In fact, at the time of diagnosis, she was an avid competitive swimmer and was widely recognized as one of the top 25 swimmers in the nation for her age group. Then suddenly, when she was 12 years old, she sprained her toe at the state swim meet. We had no idea how this event would drastically change our lives forever. What seemed like an innocent, slight injury quickly evolved into a terrible pain syndrome. She had so much pain in her left leg that she could not even bear to have any type of blanket or clothing touching her skin. In fact, even the air blowing from the vents in the hospital ceiling would cause excruciating pain. The vibration from little children riding toy cars in the corridor was enough to send her right out of the bed. Her limb would become cold, swollen, and was constantly changing colors. It was devastating for our entire family to have to sit and watch her endure this pain. Okay. Since she was only the second patient with CRPS to be treated at the children's hospital we were going to, no one really understood anything that was happening. Her doctors had only treated a couple of patients in their careers, and none of them with a pain syndrome as aggressive as Tracy's. We realized that we would have to research, provide information, and help teach the medical community as we went along. As you can imagine, this was not a very comforting role to be put in. We would rather have used the time to comfort Tracy. However, it became very apparent to us that we had to help the doctors understand the pain syndrome in order to help Tracy. Tracy was diagnosed when she was in the sixth grade. That year, she spent most of the school year in the hospital. She was treated with every pain medication possible, epidurals, sympathetic injections, and physical therapy. She missed out on normal teenage life, and that is something that she will never be able to get back. Her friends were very supportive the first year, but as time went on and she didn't get much better, they started to move on with their own lives and left Tracy behind. We cannot even begin to explain the horrendous road this has been. Watching your child go from a top athlete and a wonderful child to being confined to a wheelchair in constant pain and depressed was a terribly difficult time for our family. At age 14, the doctors had pretty much thrown in the towel and had nothing more to offer us for Tracy's pain. This was devastating. Motivated to find a way to help Tracy, we searched on our own for other options. What we found was the placement of a spinal cord stimulator. First, we had to fight for approval from our health insurance provider in order to go to the Mayo Clinic for this. And even once we were there, it was an uphill battle to get doctors to place one in a child. They finally got it approved, and she was the youngest patient to ever have it placed. The surgery was horrible for Tracy. Because of all the past spinal treatments and procedures, they had a very hard time placing it. The whole time, they needed to keep her awake so that they knew which nerves they were hitting. This procedure ended up being a success for Tracy, but the process was fraught with complications, and the wires are now screwed into her spine. The problem with this is that she will never be able to have an MRI in her life. We then found an adult pain specialist to help us, along with the pediatric doctors. This situation was messy and chaotic, to say the least. The doctors weren't willing to cooperate and communicate about Tracy's care. This is when it really hit us that we need health professionals to become more educated. We have since met one of the top researchers in the area of pediatric CRPS. Her name is Dr. Louise Ann Oaklander, and she practices at Mass General. She was absolutely appalled at the amount of needles that were placed in Tracy's back for treatment. Once again, this confirms the lack of education and knowledge about CRPS in the medical community, even at a nationally renowned children's hospital and Mayo Clinic. Just when we felt her life was back on track, CRPS struck again. She was walking down the hallway at school and accidentally was bumped into the lockers. This immediately triggered the spread of her pain syndrome into her arms. They both turned purple, and the signature severe pain followed. This was such a sad day for all of us. Just when we thought the pain and agony was under control, CRPS struck again. She ended up having another spinal cord stimulator surgically placed in her upper spine to help with the pain in her arms. Treatment in Tracy's case was very aggressive. We think this was a positive aspect of her care, but it's very hard to watch and much harder for Tracy, who had to endure all of it. Over the last 7 years, she has had over 110 procedures and sometimes required lengthy hospital stays. Because of the careful maneuvering that these procedures demand, Tracy had to be awake for all of the procedures. She would have epidural catheters placed in her spine to numb her legs. They would leave these catheters in for a couple of weeks. She had dozens of sympathetic injections and injections into her neck, which would either work or make things 10 times worse. But we had no choice to try. Throughout these last 7 years, we have done our best to help Tracy lead somewhat of a normal life. Her CRPS goes into remission and then flares up with stressors, illness, and any type of mild injury. This means that we always have to be on top of the pain and continually try to find doctors that specialize in CRPS. A major obstacle surrounding this pain syndrome is that the majority of the medical professionals are not aware of CRPS. Even among the small number of professionals that do know about it, there is no standardized treatment due to the limited understanding of the pain syndrome. This makes each case somewhat trial and error scenario until a treatment method is found that is effective for that specific patient. The lack of awareness and understanding of CRPS also creates additional problems, as in some cases the condition is not visible, which leads to caregivers to speculate that the condition is in the person's head or they are drug seekers, just looking for narcotics, which in all cases immensely complicates the entire situation. These accusations increase stress for the patient, ultimately increasing the severity of the flare-ups. We were fortunate that Tracy was diagnosed fairly quickly and that her doctors began aggressive treatment. This is not the norm. For many people, it can take years of pain and frustration just to get the diagnosis. Early intervention is vital with CRPS. Education and knowledge about CRPS plays a key role in effectively treating the pain syndrome. Even more difficult in our case was the fact that Tracy was diagnosed as a child. So we had the additional element of pediatric care to complicate things. There are a handful of specialists who deal with the children with CRPS, but they are mainly on the East Coast. We had wonderful doctors, but they had clearly not dealt with anything like Tracy's case with CRPS. We want to thank State Representative Melissa Hortman for listening to us about Tracy's struggle with CRPS and taking the initiative to do something to help others in the future. We came here to share with you what this pain syndrome can do to a child or teen. It is something no parent should ever have to go through. It is a great pleasure to be part of this process and to put a face to this pain syndrome. Education and awareness is essential with any pain syndrome, and this is particularly true with CRPS. We truly believe if this bill is passed, it will bring light to the condition, therefore helping people of all ages deal with it and get proper treatment. Tracy does not want another child to suffer the pain she had to endure, not only with the pain syndrome, but with the lack of educated providers in Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Other questions? Does anybody know what do we understand the cause of it?
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, maybe we'll get that later on. Okay.
The brain starts misfiring pain.
Okay. And so it's just
neurological.
Okay, so it's set off by the one incident,
yep.
But then something fires differently. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then the spinal cord stimulator is interfering, so that's sending a different signal, trying to confuse her brain.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for coming today. And I think Lori Drummond, Representative Saylor, if you want to come on down too. Thank you so much, Bill, for taking the time.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Thiessen and members of the committee. I also very much appreciate the fact that we're able to be here at this hearing today. This constituent of mine, Lori Drummond, had contacted me some time ago with telling me about, you know, her experience, the experience of her family with this CRPS, and she had very much wanted us to be able to get the story out and get, again, have more people understand what was going on with this syndrome. Interestingly enough, just yesterday, I was telling some other folks, I was at a meeting, and I was telling them I was coming down here for a hearing on this particular problem, and they said that they knew of two other people, both of whom I know in my town. I was not aware of the fact that these other folks had this same problem. And so just hearing Lori telling me about what had happened and what is currently going on with her and with her family and treatment options or not options, it has certainly raised my awareness of it. And as I said, I was very surprised to learn just yesterday that there were two additional people that I was unaware of completely in my own community that have the same problem. So I would like to turn this over to Lori Drummond at this time. She would be certainly more able to speak to it than I will.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good afternoon, all. My name is Lori Drummond. I was diagnosed with CRPS on March 1st, 2007, as a result from injuries and surgeries done which had occurred to both knees. At the time of diagnosis, I only had it from my knees on down. Within a year, it spread to my lower back. The only reason why I remember that date so well is because it was the beginning of a new life. A new life of uncertainty. A life of constantly living with chronic pain. A life not knowing what the day will be like for me. And a life of having to fight for my right to be heard. I had seen three different doctors, and not one of them could tell me why I was in so much pain. They kept telling me that I shouldn't be having this much pain, since the kind of surgeries I had weren't that intense. I knew something was wrong, and if the doctors in my hometown couldn't give me an answer, I decided to go to a different doctor out of state. When I went to see the doctor in Fargo, he had me do a test, a bone scan, to see what was going on. After a month of waiting, because the hospital in my hometown lost the x-rays, the answer to my question, why am I hurting so much, was finally answered. I had CRPS. Like many people, I never heard of CRPS. Since no doctor had explained to me what it is, I had to learn about it on my own. I went to rsbhope.org and did some research on it. While reading the symptoms of CRPS, the first word that came out of my mouth was, this is exactly what I'm going through. Little did I know that it was also the beginning of a long, hard battle. I thought that once I was diagnosed, the doctors in my hometown would help me out. How wrong I was. What I did find out was that they would blame my pain on other things, like depression. They didn't know why I was hurting so bad. They told me I was using the pain as an excuse for secondary gain for disability. Doctors said that I believed I had CRPS because I got information off the internet. The doctor, which I had trusted the most, had told me that he had never seen it in both limbs before. He had only seen it in one limb. Not only was it a struggle for me to get a proper diagnosis as to why I was having severe constant pain, it was and still is a struggle for me today to get the proper pain medication to help me with the pain. It's also still a struggle for me when I go to the emergency room or see a doctor in my hometown because they don't know what CRPS is. It's not just the doctors that don't know a lot about it, it's also the nurses. There are numerous times when I need to tell them what CRPS is. If they suggest putting ice where it's swollen, I have to explain to them that I can't do that, for ice is bad for CRPS, it can make it worse. Not only has CRPS disabled me, it also is hard on me mentally and emotionally. I no longer can do the things which I was once able to do. Take a nice long walk, work, gardening, play with our dog, or even drive. All those things I once enjoyed doing is now just a dream. My condition has also affected my family emotionally and financially. Since I am unable to do the things that a mother and wife is supposed to do, it has taken its toll on my family. Since I'm unable to do the things I once was able to do, my children and husband have to pick up the extra work at home. Before RSD, the CRPS, I was able to take care of my family the way a mother and wife should. Now the tables have turned, and they have to help me. It breaks my heart when my son tells me there is nothing wrong with him, when in fact there is. He wants his old mom back. My husband has to take off work to take me to the doctor's appointment. Last year alone, my husband had to take off work so many times during the month, we fell behind in our bills. There were numerous times when we received shut-off notices and couldn't charge to get any fuel for the winter because we were behind. Even though we had explained the situation, it didn't matter to them. The only thing that mattered to them was that they weren't getting their money. That put a huge strain on my husband. He was worried day in and day out about how we were going to survive. As for me, I was feeling guilty that I couldn't work because of what was going on with me. This is only part of my story about what it's like for me living with CRPS. I have given you a copy of my story of RSD, so you may read further and in detail as to what it is like for me to live with this before, during, and after this illness. As I found out, CRPS can happen to anyone, at any time, at any age, any place on your body. A person can get it from an injury, surgery, fracture, broken bones, or in some instances, for no reason at all. It is the most painful form of chronic pain which exists today. It does not matter where you live, for people all over the world can get this condition. As you can see from the McHale Pain Index, the pain is worse than giving birth, broken bone, or even cancer. Many go undiagnosed because there is no awareness and the medical field is undereducated about it. No two people have the same symptoms of CRPS, which includes swelling, nail and hair growth changes, the affected limb is shiny, the discoloration in the skin, and many more. Each person reacts differently with the pain medication that is given to them. What works for one does not mean it will work for the other. However, there are a few things that we do have in common. Our doctors do not know much about our illness. Our family members do not know what it's like to live with it. We are either told that it is depression that's causing it, it's in our head, we are only seeking attention, we're using it as an excuse to get disability, or they just don't listen to us. When we say we hurt, we hurt. We just want our voices to be heard so we can get the help that we so rightfully deserve. If there is more awareness and education for CRPS, then we wouldn't have to live in silence and struggle on a daily basis with the doctors, nurses, the public, the schools, our families, and most of all, we won't have to struggle to survive. We need more education so that maybe someday there will be a cure for the pain in which we have to live with 24/7, 365 days a year. Thank you for letting me share with you all what it's like for me to live with CRPS. There needs to be more awareness and education so that our voices will be heard, so that others will know what it's like to live with CRPS. I have a letter here that is from a 17-year-old girl who lives in Minnesota here, and she wants her voice to be heard too. When I was 13 years old, I fell on my snowboard and broke my wrist. 3 weeks later, my cast was removed, and you could see a molded purple wrist. Nobody knew what was wrong. I did months of painful PT where I would cry constantly and also had over 15 ER visits where they could give me pain meds that would do nothing and would get to the point where they just sedated me to stop my crying and screaming. I tried going to school, but I was so out of it in pain meds and I could not write with my swollen purple hand and wrist. 8 months after my fall, they did surgery on my wrist to fix the orthopedic problem from my fall. My wrist was immobilized, which exacerbated my pain. Finally, after I got my stitches out, I went to the Children's Hospital ER, where I stayed a couple of days. They referred me to the pain clinic where I was diagnosed with CRPS. They put me back into PT and started me on nerve medications, which did not do much, and soon after it spread up my arm and into the other. I am now 17 years old and heading into my senior year of high school. Despite missing many days of school due to hospital stays and doctor's visits, I managed to still get good grades and get into honor society despite getting only 2-3 hours of sleep a night and not eating enough due to nausea from the pain. CRPS has completely changed my life. I went through a stage where my hypersensitivity was so bad I could not wear any sleeves on my arms, and it was minus 20 degrees outside. And I went to school in tank tops. I could not even lay my arms down on the sheets of my bed to sleep. A slight wind would make me cry. Also, I had to go to school with an arm that would not stop shaking or twitching. My teacher would call on me, but I never raised my hand intentionally. I have missed out on so many school activities. I have missed dances and football games because I cannot get bumped or touched. I can no longer play tennis, which is what I love, and I can no longer swim the way I could either. I now go to new pain clinic where they have done stellate ganglion blocks on me. Do you know how scary it is to get a long needle stuck to your neck right after they tell you all the risks of this procedure, which include getting paralyzed, nerve damage, possibility of your lung collapsing, or hitting an artery in your neck and stuff like that? There needs to be more awareness of this terrible condition, because I am sick and tired of health professionals not believing me and telling me my pain is in my head. I had to spend 3 weeks in a psychiatric day facility because my doctor thought I was crazy. Through all this, I have wanted to give up, but how can I give up? The pain will still be there if I give up, so I might as well fight it, but it would help a lot if more people could understand what I am going through. If they could feel a quarter of the pain I feel, they would be down on their knees crying, "Please, please, please pass this bill so we have a possibility to have a pain-free day." There's a couple of things I'd like to show y'all too. This right here is how people see us with RSD. But this right here is how RSD really feels. As you can tell, we may look the same, not sick on the outside, but we do. We're sick on the inside. We feel the burn, we feel the light, the electricity, we feel everything. This is a painful condition.
Thank you so much for coming today. Are there questions? We have a couple other testifiers who want to talk about this, but I really appreciate you coming out and sharing your story.
Thank you.
It's helpful to know, and frustrating, I imagine.
It is.
Bonnie Scherer. Scherer. Welcome to the committee. And then Julie Manns and Kate Healy are the other. Okay. So one question is, I should ask either of them. Are the treatments that are working and helping?
No.
No? Okay. All right. And we have about 10 or 12 minutes left for this topic, so just keep that in mind if you could. Thanks. Welcome.
Thank you. Tom Hatterley from Johns Hopkins University said if hell were a clinical medical condition, it might look something like RSD. We are honored to be here today, and thank you for this opportunity. I'm Bonnie Euland Scherer, and I've had RSD for over 12 years. I'm the founder of the Minnesota RSD Coalition, and we've given you each a folder that we generally hand out to our new members just to kind of let you see what part of what we do. Our basis is for a very positive outlook, as positive as you can be. We have so many members. Several of them are here. One of our members, when she was 12 years of age, just an example, she had to be sedated to get her nails trimmed. My brother-in-law was diagnosed with it after stubbing his toe. I twisted my ankle, and my personal story is in that folder. I'm not going to go into the details because I know time is limited. I am going to be delighting all of you with statistics. And we all know how fun those are. That said, I will keep it brief. Merriam-Webster defines guesstimates as an estimate usually made without adequate information. No one knows exactly how many people in the United States are affected by RSV, but experts say anywhere from 1.2 to as high as over 7 million people. Until more research is done and more doctors are educated in the correct diagnosis, it's impossible to determine a more accurate count. Using the lower figure, the 1.2 million, and Minnesota being 1.71% of the United States population, the combined total for people with breast cancer, HIV, and AIDS and muscular sclerosis in Minnesota is approximately 18,156 people, compared to approximately 20,520 people living in Minnesota with RSV, a majority of which are undiagnosed or misdiagnosed. Dutch research states that 600,000 diagnosed RSV patients from 150 physicians in Holland, where they're doing a lot of studies, the rate of recurrence has been established as 26.2 in 100,000 patients. This is approximately 1 in every 4,000 people, which means 1,300 new cases of RSV in Minnesota a year. RSVSA, a nationwide organization, did a recent study that consisted of 888 people. They found that 56% of people, it involved the lower extremities, 38% in the upper extremities. 62% of people are on disability. Now, that has a huge economic impact on the state of Minnesota. 96% of us have sleep disturbances. 86% of us report mobility problems, as I'm sure you can see. And 57% of us struggle with self-care. When I talk about dignity, I used to be a very independent person, and I'm not going to wallow in self-pity. I won't do that. But I do have my moments. I mean, when my husband has to come and just try and get me out of bed, when I'm unable to make it to the bathroom, when I'm in a flare-up and I'm sick and I can't make it in time, I mean, it's amazing. I can't do laundry anymore. I've blacked out while driving, not because of the medications I'm on, but because of my blood pressure and what this disease has done with the extreme pain, and then it eases. It affects so many people in so many different ways. As you've been told, the RSV is ranked 42 in the McGill Pain Index, which means it is the most chronic pain condition that exists. 40% of all patients have been to 10 or more physicians since getting RSV. Things like a drop in the barometric pressure increases the pain in 75% of us, and it spreads in 80% of people with RSV. I am full body RSV. I have it in my mouth, which I can never go to a dentist. I don't know what's going to happen, but I have it from head to toe. Surprisingly, suicide rates are very low with this disease. A majority of people have considered or thought about suicide. Of course, I mean, you're living with pain where the bright lights are extremely painful. It gets you, but I believe that the low level is testament to our medical community, and physicians, you know, are able to see things more often, they see things more clearly. Less than 1% of 1,000 people had abused prescribed pain medication. Ms. Melissa Kaplan, author and in a bibliography of pain, said a drug addict wants to escape life. A pain patient wants to live it. The study found that in the past year, 11.7 million Americans in the United States had abused illegal drugs, prescription medication, and alcohol, which is 7.6%. People in severe pain don't like the feelings they get from the medication. We don't get the highs that people without pain get. So we The only benefit we get is a decrease in pain. Yet it's next to impossible to get pain medications to be treated appropriately because doctors are very concerned. The human brain has what's called a reward center, which tells us if something is enjoyable. Stimulation of this reward center releases one of the body's chemicals called dopamine. Pain medication by someone with no medical need for it, someone who's going to be abusing it, will get a high from it. And there's been testing done where people have been given a pain stimuli while they're taking this. People not in pain, they were given a pain stimuli and the effects were lessened significantly. People in pain, as I said, I'm being redundant, we do not get the high. We just get what we hope for is the reduction in pain. Early and accurate diagnosis and appropriate treatment are key to a positive outcome. The average time for diagnosis is 2 years. I saw 17 physicians prior to getting diagnosed. They told us to seek psychiatric help, said it was all in my head. You are able to change this to ensure the citizens of Minnesota receive proper and accurate medical care. This is in your hands. We have children with this disease, and they all ages, men and women, and to say it is life-altering is an understatement. Thank you for allowing us to speak with you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Come on up. So, this is your Julie?
Hi.
Okay. Thank you very much for testifying. And if Kate Healy also wants to come down to the table, you're welcome to. Welcome to the committee. If you can just say your name for the record, that would be great. And then whenever you're ready, go ahead.
I have some pictures to pass around. Not only going to tell you about my RRC, but I can show you what it looks like. Thank you for hearing us today. Burning toes consumed with fire no one else can see. Fiery stars race across the last frontiers of my feet. A light breeze blows and screams of misery rise, but stillness reigns when no one else can see the silent flames. I wrote this poem right after my diagnosis, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, and it's true, no one else can see the flames of RSD, but I guarantee I can feel them. I feel the flames licking at my toes, the electrical shocks, the deep stabbing, but there's no fire, no outlet, no knife. Every time I smile, someone says, "Oh, what a beautiful smile. You must be feeling better. You don't look sick." But I am sick, with pain that never ends. It's so frustrating living with an invisible disease. That's why I'm here today, looking at how my life changed forever. Aspects of my life before RSD and the role of the powerful medications that I take every day, I hope to illustrate the painful realities of living with complex regional pain syndrome. On June 12th, I underwent a routine surgery to remove two bone spurs from my right ankle. I had 9 similar surgeries without complications. I knew something was wrong right away when I awoke in the recovery room screaming with intensely burning pain. After numerous attempts to quiet me, including IV painkillers and nerve blocks, the nursing staff deemed my pain controlled enough to send me home. The next day, when the nerve blocks wore off, I started screaming in earnest. My young daughter made arrangements for me to go to the emergency room. I was admitted for a 3-day stay with painkillers that were very powerful, but my pain persisted through those medications. 2 weeks later, during a trip to the emergency room, I learned the spasms in my hands and my feet were due to lack of oxygen. Turns out I've been holding my breath for 3 weeks. I pant quickly and then hold my breath just to get through the pain. Incredibly, this whole time, the surgeon's office insisted the pain was normal because they'd never seen or heard of RSV. I kept saying the pain wasn't normal. Remember that I'd had 9 previous surgeries without complication. I know my body, and I knew normal surgical recovery, and I knew this wasn't it. Finally, a neurologist diagnosed me with complex regional pain surgery syndrome type 2. I have permanent nerve damage in my right foot and ankle. My foot is red and white and blue and brown and purple. It's at least 10 to 15 degrees colder than the rest of my body at all times. I can't wear a shoe because of the extreme sensitivity and the extreme swelling. There's notable bone loss in my toes and my foot, according to my last x-ray. A new and startling bone-crushing pain has developed due to the osteoporosis that has set in to my right foot and chin. The whole bottom of my foot is numb, especially my toes. But I can still feel the burning, the stabbing, the shock. I always wear a fuzzy sock, not just for protection and warmth, but also to spare others the sight of my ugly foot. In February and ongoing this year, my pain doctors have confirmed that RSV is spreading to my left foot, up both legs and into my buttocks and into my hands. I battle not only the physical pain of RSV, but deep depression and anxiety. This was not always the case. I went from super mom to chronic pain patient during the course of a same-day surgery. And wow, that's a hard change to accept. All of a sudden, I was no longer a corporate employee climbing the ladder faster than anyone in my department. I was no longer an MS-150 volunteer and bike rider, a dancer in my daughter's dance troupe, a fitness walker and fitness swimmer, a trick diver, forward and backward flips were my specialties, a skier, a skater, a choir member, a soccer coach, so many more things that defined Julie Mann. The list of what I could do became very short. Sit, lie down, pray, cry, scream, worry. Today my greatest fear is that somebody will touch my foot because of the intense pain even the lightest touch will bring. It's called allodynia. It means pain out of proportion to stimuli which are not normally painful, like wind, noise, light touch. Even with all my medications on board, they are only somewhat effective with dealing with the pain and offer many side effects. I take these medications not because I want to, but because I have to. I don't know what I would do without them, especially when the pain is so severe that I can't walk at all or use my hands and now my shoulders. I burst into tears without any provocation. I wake from deep sleep crying out with pain. My medications are not a choice. They get me through my days. The names of my powerful medications range from the familiar to the unfamiliar. Oxycontin, Percocet, Ativan, Cymbalta, Lamictal, Topamax. I'm happy to say that Topamax does a great job controlling the burn. And my RSV is better controlled than it was a year ago. But no medication cures RSV. And I still live with all the symptoms, plus the cruel and embarrassing side effects. I sometimes call Topamax Dopamax because I sound like a dope when I lose my words or use the wrong ones or completely forget really important events or information. RSV by itself affects cognition and memory, then add the double whammy of the medicinal side effects that also affect cognition and memory, plus concentration, and fatigue and depression, and anxiety and mood swings, and a potentially lethal rash that I'm always vigilant to watch for. Yes, I'm willing to deal with these side effects in order to live with some semblance of life, although nowhere near my former self. The onset of symptoms, the changes to my life, and the realities of my medication seem overwhelming, don't they? But I'm here today with a smile on my face. The silent flames are burning, but I'm surviving the best I can. I attend church each week, leaning on the Lord frequently. My friends and my family provide constant support. My husband is my best friend. He takes great care of me even while working more than full time. My 9 3/4-year-old daughter willingly uses her feet most times without complaint. My mom drives me around the Twin Cities and serves as my memory at all of my important appointments. I swim almost every day. Instead of doing fitness swimming, I do the doggy paddle and a quick kick with just one foot. I'm an advocate and activist for RSD and CRPS. I joined the Minnesota RSD Coalition right away, and I volunteer every way I can. I found a whole family of support on Facebook, and I'm active in their RSD and CRPS clubs. Today I'm not speaking just for myself, but I'm speaking for all my brothers and sisters in pain who help me through my bad days as I try to help them through theirs. But no matter which support club that I'm participating in, we all share the same goal, to stop the burn and put out the silent flame. Thank you for hearing us today.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll try to make this short and sweet for you. My name's Kate Healy, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Chronic pain, CRIPS, the first diagnosis, was over 100 years ago by physician Silas Mitchell in the Civil War. The doctors back then, and still today, a lot of them think that it's all psychological. It's in your head. You don't have the pain, there's no reason to have the pain, but it's still there. There is significant controversy and confusion surrounding the diagnosis of chronic renal pain syndrome due to several factors, including lack of universal recognition of CRIPS, I'm not going to keep saying it up, as a legitimate diagnosis. Those who feel it is significantly, professionals range from not considering CRIPS as a legitimate diagnosis, and those who feel it is significant. Now, we just example underdiagnosed, especially in the early ages. Patients may be seen for different types of physicians for their symptoms, such as a primary care physician or an orthopedist, who may not be familiar with RSD, perhaps because they have never seen it, or in their practice, or they think RSD is a rare disease, they do not include it in their differential diagnosis. I'm going to kind of flip around here for you guys because it's been a long one. Sorry. I guess I keep going. There is no gold standard regarding the diagnosis criteria for RSD. There are several different guidelines that have been published, and each differs in terms and number of signs and symptoms which must be presented in order to reach the diagnosis. Even so, the criteria set out in 1994 guideline of the, it's another IASP, continue to be the most widely used for the diagnosis of RSD. But there is little evidence of involvement of the reflex mechanism. Symptoms of RSD. Now I can talk. Symptoms of RSD reflect and complicate interplay of several neurological symptoms, such as peripheral and central. Only an onset of patients respond to treatment to reduce pain called a sympathetic block, which interrupts the activity of the sympathetic nervous system, indicating that not all RSD pain is sympathetically medicated. Dystrophy
which means degeneration of muscle or tissue, is present only in a subset of RSV patients, approximately 10%. In response to these inconsistencies, the International Association for the Study of Pain adopted the term complex regional pain syndrome in 1994 to describe a debilitating pain syndrome that develops after relatively minor surgery to an extremity or arm but lasts longer than actual injury and is more severe or otherwise to be expected for an injury. There are two types, as you guys have heard. Trying not to keep...
Is there, is insurance cover this pretty well?
Mine does.
Okay.
Others don't.
Yeah. It all depends on what your doctor is asking for and whatnot. It can be very, very hard to get any... The major complications that people have with this is being diagnosed. I worked in a clinic. I worked with some great internists, and I really do still think they are really good doctors. And when my hips started to get sore, and they thought it was bursitis, and I went cortisone, cortisone, cortisone. Well, then it started, my foot was being, started to get sore, so they thought, well, maybe it's your shoe. So we checked that. I was checked for Lyme disease. I was checked for everything. And finally, I was diagnosed with RSV. And they thought, oh, it's only going to be long term. And the one doctor that was there that him and I didn't clash was the only one that said, Kate, it's chronic. It's never going to go away. My personal story really quick is due to this disease, I have lost my job, my home due to the financial and you get foreclosed on. My daughter's respect because she doesn't understand this disease and she's 30 years old, but she has a problem with pain medications. And my marriage and my ability to live independently. Right now I live with my sister and I'm just moving forward. There's no way I can look back. I'm blessed enough to be able to walk and to do things and to look like a person that doesn't walk around with chronic pain all the time. And I'm able to hold a part-time job. But as my sister has seen, after work, there are days I come home and I lay in bed. I am too tired to do anything else. And part of my RSD has went into my intestines. So that can be very, very tricky to eat. Or to have a bowel movement, it's very, very painful. But, and I'm one of the weird ones that have stayed skinny because of the medication. I do the opposite. So.
I need to interrupt, but could I touch on that insurance?
Yeah, and then I think we're going to have to move on, but
yeah,
thank you for coming down. But let's,
A majority of people with RSV lose our jobs. We are not very fortunate. We're not fortunate in that we get a lot of coverage. As much as we appreciate Medicare, help Medicare, I have no idea where I'd be at this point. I still pay over $3,000 a month. I was supposed to pay over $3,000 a month for my subscriptions alone. Medicare is getting $997 a month. My husband has had several strokes. He is retired at 63 years of age. He brings in $666 a month. We've had to sell our home. Insurance does not cover a lot of it. There were a lot of treatment modalities that insurance would not cover at all. So they couldn't be tried. In turn, the disease has gotten much worse.
Can I just one last thing? What we're asking of you, in the medical community, there is no education. It's just lightly nipped upon. And when I was going to school, when he said RSV, I had no idea what I had. And I'm a nurse. I'm like, wow, what's this? And that's what they need. We need laws
that doctors and nurses and physical therapists are educated in the new options and, you know, what to do with RSV. So the people that are newly diagnosed will get the treatment right away, will get a chance to go into remission. The rest of us, we kind of pray, but we really want this to stop. We really want this to not have more kids that get this. That is, to me, the most horrifying thing.
We want our voices heard.
Yeah, well, and I thank you for coming. And this is, this is online, and so if you want to send people to the house website, you should be able to. It'll be stored, and it's streaming online right now, but people can go there. So if you want to refer people to the to find out about it, you can do that. You can contact Kate to get the information for that. And we'll have to follow. I mean, we'll follow up on where we can go from here to figure out what our role can be. So, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
And turn over to Representative Lane.
Thank you, Representative Tyson. As these people were telling us, without awareness, there's not much action that's taken, and that's my concern with the pandemic preparedness for the flu that is moving around the globe. America's been pretty nonchalant about it. You know, it's a flu, but we'll be fine. It's a pandemic, yes, but it's very mild. We've been scared before with SARS or with avian flu. And a few years ago, the committee in the House that's responsible for pandemic preparedness budget looked at the amount set aside for the pandemic preparedness and laughed. And two of us did not laugh. We were a little bit older. We had some connection from our family into what happened in 1918. My father was born in 1918 and was very ill as a baby, but he survived. And Representative John Benson's father was a teen in World War I, and I believe it was in Texas where his job was moving the dead bodies, and then he became very ill, and they always felt that his weaker constitution was from his very severe case of the flu back then. So we had some awareness, we'd heard the stories, and now, since then, I've learned a lot more, and I feel even more reason for concern. And I say concern, not fear, because fear stops you, but concern wakes you up, and that's what I'm looking forward here is more awareness, a bit of a wake-up. We need to be aware. Three key points I would quickly make is compared to the seasonal flu, this is a different and unusual strain. It's already become a pandemic. It's gone quickly around the globe, and it's not stopping. And two, it's different and unusual ages that are hit than in the seasonal flu. You'll hear about that. And also, if it becomes virulent, if it becomes deadly, more deadly than it is, then in today's society it could have different and unusual societal and economic impact. So those are the three things I'd like to look at today and bring more awareness to this, because actions follow naturally if you are aware. And with that, we'd like to start with Dr. Michael Osterholm, who is the director at the Center for Infectious Disease at the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Dr. Osterholm.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Michael Osterholm. I'm the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, professor in the School of Public Health and the School of Medicine. And I welcome the opportunity to be with you today, committee and Representative Lane, and I'd be happy to cover any aspect that you would like to address as it relates to the issue around what we're about to see over the upcoming weeks and months.
Well, if you could give us some background on the status of the flu across the globe right now and what some of your concerns are.
Well, first of all, let me just make sure that we're all on the same page as it relates to what we're talking about. Influenza, which is a viral infection that typically causes pneumonia, muscle aches, fever, chills, and so forth, among the seasonal flu period of the year, which for the Northern Hemisphere is typically late fall through the early winter, early spring months. In the Southern Hemisphere, their influenza season is during our summer, which of course they have just been experiencing right now. There's a variety of reasons why that occurs, of which none of them yet are a satisfactory answer why we see it seasonally and it disappears during those months that we wouldn't otherwise expect to see it. All influenza viruses actually come from wild aquatic birds. It turns out that in the evolutionary tree of life, wild aquatic birds emerged about 100 million years before chickens did. And somewhere during that 100 million years, wild aquatic birds picked up this virus in their gastrointestinal tract and carried it around. There are 154 different kinds of influenza viruses that are in the family of the influenza A virus, the one that we think of seasonally. This is where the H and the N come in. You hear about H and N. H is the hemagglutinin, which is part of the virus. N is the neuraminidase, which is part of the virus. And that's why we classify them H1 through 16, H and N 1 through 9. Occasionally, these viruses make their way from birds and into humans. That only occurs when the virus changes sufficiently so that basically it can infect a human lung cell. And then once it's in a human lung cell, basically get out. And it takes a long and arduous process for that to occur. Sometimes it happens when two influenza viruses mix it up in the same host, like a pig, which is an animal species that can become readily infected by multiple influenza strains simultaneously. Sometimes it happens just by mutational issues. We talk about microbes in general, where they just mutate. And what we worry about every year as a seasonal flu is basically the remnants of a previous pandemic. A pandemic of influenza occurs when, in fact, a new strain emerges out of the animal population, one which humans haven't seen or most humans haven't seen, and then it circles the globe for 18 to 24 months, causing an increased illness, and in some cases, a very severe illness compared to seasonal flu. The situation we have now is that we had pandemics in 1918 caused by a strain called H1N1, the kind that we're seeing right now. We believe it originated potentially in the swine population, or in fact they may have just been co-infected at the same time. That lasted until 1957, when a new strain emerged from Asia, which we now know is in fact a mix of birds and human genes getting together. That was H2N2. That disappeared in 1968 when H3N2 came along, again another bird-human mix. That one went until the mid-70s when H1N1 from the earlier period got out of a laboratory in Russia, we believe, and began to co-circulate with H3N2. So since the late or mid-1970s, we've actually had two seasonal flu strains every year we've dealt with, H1N1 seasonal flu, H3N2. Well, it so happens that this new strain is an H1N1 that's as different as Donald Paul Peterson and Donald Paul Peterson might be if one lived in Brainerd and one lived in Minneapolis. They might have very similar names, but they're very different. The H1N1 we're seeing now that just emerged is very different than the one that was in the seasonal flu strains of the past years. So in a sense, we have a new strain. Now, the good news is, if you were born before 1957, which I think there are a couple of people in the room that might qualify for that, you probably actually had exposure to that circulating H1N1 that disappeared in 1957 when the new pandemic came along, and we do see increased protection among the older population. The other good news, if you did get the swine flu vaccine in 1976, it turns out that we have now evidence that there's fairly good residual cross-protection among the 45 million Americans, of which today we believe only about 35 million are still alive, that got the vaccine in 1976. So we do have protection among part of the population in terms of this new strain. But it did emerge out of the Mexican area in April of this year. It has taken its toll primarily in those under age 50 to 55, and it has challenged the healthcare systems around the world, most notably recently in the Southern Hemisphere. For those of us in public health, this was a very notable event. To see widespread influenza activity in Minnesota in July is unheard of, just absolutely unheard of, and we had it. The media covered this with a vengeance the first 3 to 4 weeks in April and May, made it seem as if we were all going to die, of which, of course, we tried hard to tone that back and tone that down. And then, just as quickly as they started to cover it, they quit covering it when all of us weren't going to die. And so, for many people, there's been a sense that this has dropped off the radar screen, and it hardly has done that. It has been a very serious problem in the Southern Hemisphere countries of Argentina, Chile, Peru, Australia, and has surely challenged their healthcare systems, has challenged their business areas there, and it has challenged their governments. We now are concerned that this is going to be coming to North America, as it is all the Northern Hemisphere countries, over the next few weeks to months. And as you may know, we are working on a vaccine for this. The problem with this vaccine is one that it is a part of an archaic vaccine manufacturing system for influenza that many of us asked 20 years ago that we invest in and change. It is basically a 1950s vaccine technology approach, only modernized with a couple of new changes. But basically it's growing the virus in chicken eggs, waiting 4 to 6 months to harvest it, and then having vaccine available that is really going to be in short amount in this country. At best right now, we're hopeful that we might have enough to vaccinate about 100 million people out of the 310 million citizens. by November or December, which means a lot of us will be held without vaccine during that time period. It's of note that the groups we are targeting for vaccine right now happen to be children, obviously because of the younger age groups and the impact it's had, pregnant women who have had been disproportionately hit by both severe disease as well as disease in general, and key occupational areas like healthcare workers and so forth, where we have to maintain that infrastructure. That means the vast majority of Americans who are in the workforce between ages 20 and 50 will not be protected, even under the best of circumstances coming into the next month. And while we're not suggesting that there's going to be high, high mortality rates in this group, it is going to be extremely disruptive in terms of lost time, people sick, and it will stress our healthcare system. In the great debate today on healthcare, which of course many of us appropriately call a disease care system, we all recognize that we have basically gnawed that system down to the bone and we're sucking calcium. We have no surge capacity. We brought the healthcare system right here in Minnesota right to the edge just during the summer months with the activity that we saw. There's no surge capacity. In addition, many of the products that we use today in the medical care system in this country are made offshore, just as much of our economy is. We've just completed a study looking at life-saving critical drugs that we need in this country. We went out and surveyed a group of pharmacists who are well known for their work in a variety of medical areas, and we determined that the top 30 life-saving drugs, those drugs you need every day or people die, what's on the crash cart in the emergency room, insulin, things like that, 95% of those drugs are made outside the United States. They're all generic drugs. Most of them are made in India and China, and they have very long and thin supply chains. When this disease hits India and China this fall, which we have no doubt it will do, there's no vaccine for the vast majority of people who live in India and China. And we worry about something that simple that you and I take for granted that we just think we'll go to our emergency room, we'll go to our hospitals and get. And so I could go into a laundry list of supply chain issues where today most of the needles and syringes, the IV bags, much of the medical equipment you use today, what makes ventilators work, all comes from outside the United States with no surge capacity, no storages of this somewhere else. So I think that what we're concerned about is that what disruption will cause to the rest of the world. Our group has been particularly involved with the business preparedness issue. It seems kind of odd that a public health-oriented group would be involved with business preparedness, but and yet it is not at all. Today, coal is one of those examples of a just-in-time delivery product. Half of all the coal in the United States comes from the Powder River Basin in Wyoming, for which there are 5,000 miners, for which, because of their age group, they're on nobody's radar screen for vaccine. They're the last ones to get it. This coal is brought to electrical generation plants around the United States today, for which these are done in coal trains. The engineers that drive these coal trains are nobody's radar screen. They're not in a priority list to get vaccine. And so one of the things we've been looking at are what happens if we lose electricity. Well, if you think about public health, really the father of modern public health probably should be Thomas Edison. Because, for example, the number one cause of death of children in the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul in 1900 was typhoid fever from unsafe water. With the advent of electricity, we had water pumps. With water pumps, we also had water that could be safely supplied to users, but we had sewers. With water, we had refrigeration, etc. You can see how public health was greatly benefited by something as simple as electricity. Well, today, you can't take for granted that that'll just be there because, again, it's just in time delivery of many of these products. And so one of the areas we've been working on is how stable are these systems. I'm not going to suggest to you today that all, you know, we're going to go to hell in a handbasket over the next few months. But trust me, the systems are going to be severely challenged. I look at my colleagues at the Minnesota Department of Health, an agency I think that has been a national leader in preparing us for pandemic influenza, and I have to tell you, we're very fortunate to have who we have at that department. But think about the fact this group was strung out for 8 to 10 weeks this spring with just the occurrence of H1N1 and all the response needs that were there. Now imagine we're going to ask them to overlay a complicated vaccine strategy to deliver a vaccine to a large segment of Minnesotans. At the same time, the problem this fall is going to be much worse than it was this spring. Trust me, even if you don't see any change in the virus in terms of disease severity, but just 2 to 3 times the number of cases, which clearly during our flu season, we can expect that to happen, this group is going to be incredibly stretched. We're going to be asking them basically to respond to 4 or 5 I-35W bridge collapses on the same night. And so I think the committee and our government in general has to understand what's about to happen and what that requirement of effort will be and how capable are we going to be able to respond. Do not count on the healthcare system to respond with a robust response. They basically, as I've already pointed out, are already really at the stretched edge in terms of surge capacity. We did a recent study and involved with work here in Minnesota, just looking at something as simple as mechanical ventilators, the things that we all assume we're going to have and need during a pandemic. And it turns out that in that case, the ventilators themselves are short supply, but that's not the problem. There's a thing called the circuit, a disposable device that attaches to the ventilator. And right now we have major shortages of circuits all through Minnesota. All of them are made outside the United States. There's a backlog in supply orders that aren't going to be here. We're going to be responding in our healthcare system with many, many shortages like this. And so I think that the reality we want to share with you today is, no, this is not likely at this point to be another 1918 where we're going to see 2 to 5% of populations die. But we are going to see, overlaid in a global just-in-time economy, a very stressful situation coming up over the upcoming weeks and months. Now, let me just add one last kicker to this, which is going to actually have a real impact or potential impact that we're not yet sure of. It turns out that I mentioned earlier that the seasonal flu strains H3N2 and H1N1, the old H1N1, were something we worry about every year. There are people around this table who I know have had influenza, and in some cases, pretty severe cases, and you know how you felt. It's like you've been hit by a pickup truck at 40 miles an hour. Well, it turns out that during the last month of H1N1, we've been spared the morbidity and mortality in the elderly population, or the older population as such, because this was H1N1. But it turns out that we did in the southern hemisphere during their flu season see a proportion of the cases, granted it was small, but a proportion of the cases of H3N2 continue to occur in the older population. Well, it so happens that this year, because how fast this virus can mutate or change, that in fact it is a very poor match with the seasonal flu strain this year. So the H3N2 that was chosen to be in the vaccine 8 months ago does not match up well with what is now circulating in the southern hemisphere. So what we're very concerned about is we may get a double hit simultaneously. H1N1 in the younger population, which we never usually see, plus a potential for increased incidence of disease in the older population, those with underlying health problems with H3N2, which would really be a bad mix in terms of the healthcare system. So with that, that's really the background. I know you're going to hear from our colleagues here in the state, from the Department of Health, as I can't say enough about the incredible job they've done to get us better prepared. Our group is actively involved. We're hosting an international summit here on September 22nd, 23rd with business communities from around the world that will be looking at what can businesses do and actually how can they deal with their employees, how do they maintain their supply chains, what do they do if both of those are not readily available, how can we keep basically the wheels on the train and keep the train running. And right now we think that's the important goal, is to get us through the next 6 to 8 months by keeping the trains running. So with that, Representative, I think for our conversation, that's kind of the overview that we talked about, and I hope that that is what you were looking for the committee's
information. Yeah, I'm just wondering if there might be some questions for you. I would like you to talk a little bit more about how this virus mutates, or how viruses mutate, and the concerns. Even if this comes back as it is now, it's a little bit more mild, but what is the concern as far as mutations go?
Well, first of all, let me just point out that all living agents have mutations. Okay. You know, we are a bag of mutations literally every day. We have cells that dysfunction, don't reproduce appropriately. Unfortunately, some of those turn into things called cancers. But in fact, in the microorganism area, because their reproduction life is so short, sometimes 20 minutes, and you have a whole new generation, in a day you have more generations than we've had since this country was discovered. Basically, that is a problem, particularly when they're producing so many of these organisms. The flu virus, one of the microorganisms in the microbe world that we know has a very, very high propensity for not making itself exactly like it was, meaning it doesn't have certain machinery on board to correct mistakes when it reproduces the genetic material. That's why, think about, of all the agents that we have vaccines for today, which one is it that we have to change every year just to be able to have a vaccine that hopefully closely matches that which is circulating? You know, we don't do that with mumps, measles, rubella, any of those other diseases, because this one has such a dysfunctional ability to reproduce itself the same way. Well, when that happens, any one of these mutations can surely mean that the agent just dies. It's not functional. But occasionally it means it can also produce an agent which is much more virulent or capable of producing more and severe disease and also survive. That's what we worry about. But also, influenza viruses have another property, which in fact the previous two pandemics were how that resulted, and that's called the concept of reassortment. Reassortment occurs when two influenza viruses of totally different origin get into the same lung cell, which they can. Influenza virus is one of the most promiscuous swappy viruses we know, and they'll be happy to swap out genes with any of its cousins at any moment. And so what happens occasionally is we actually get an influenza virus that's a mix of two different agents. And in fact, this current swine flu strain, which we has unfortunately been called swine flu, is actually just the result of what we call a triple reassortment. It's actually taken a bit of virus that came primarily from pig strains, from bird strains, and human strains, and brought it all together under one umbrella. And so the question you're asking is, could things get worse? Yes, they could definitely get worse. This particular strain has a high propensity, because of the way the genetic material is assembled, to actually have some changes. And what we're dealing with right now might not be what we're dealing with 3 months from now. It might be, might not be, we don't know. But even if it doesn't change, it's going to be bad enough the way it is. But we have to be prepared for that. And so, yes, we're concerned about that, and this virus is surely one that could, in a moment's notice, change.
Thank you, Representative Rood.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for being here. It's always a pleasure and terrifying to hear you speak. I have two questions. They're a little unrelated, and I'm wondering if my facts are right. I had heard that the flu epidemic pandemic in the 1900s, early 1900s, hit young people disproportionately, people in the 20s, because of their immune response was so fantastic. And so my concern as the mother of somebody who's going off to college, who will be staying in a dorm, I'm wondering if the young people are going to be prioritized as far as the vaccines. And kind of another related question is the vaccine going to be given in two different doses? And as somebody who also works in healthcare, that's such a nightmare because we don't have electronic medical records everywhere and the ability to track that. So if you could address
this. Yes. Thank you, Representative Rood. Yeah. For your commentary and my presence here, I my children often say the same thing about Terry. First of all, let me start out by saying you're going to hear more from our colleagues in the Minnesota Department of Health. We'll be talking specifically about the vaccine issue. Let me make a couple of comments. One is, as we've learned more and more about the 1918 situation, and I should have basically offered a disclaimer to this group when I started. I knew a heck of a lot more about influenza 10 years ago than I know today. I actually lead one of the five NIH centers for influenza research, and I actually chair the executive committee of all five centers, and am very involved in everything from the very basic research on influenza viruses up to the population-based studies. And all of us who work in this area are humbled by how much we thought we knew that we don't know, that we're now learning that we need to relearn. So I would tell you that what I answer about 1918 is we know a lot more today than we did even 5 to 7 years ago. And it turns out there that there may be a similar situation that those who are older were protected from a similar virus that circulated probably in the 1880s or earlier. So there may have been some protection there. But one of the things we're learning about today is that, in fact, the people who are dying from H1N1 actually are dying of a very impressive disease. The lung pathology we're seeing in these cases is actually even unlike what we're seeing with avian influenza or bird flu, which was very serious, and even more so than we saw with 1918. It's very, very deep in the lungs. It's causing a very severe disease. The immune response may play a part of the role. And in fact, in a paper published later this week in the New England Journal of Medicine describes the cases from Mexico in which clearly this dysregulated immune system response may have played a very important role in that. But the bottom line is that this is a bad, bad disease. We know that pregnancy is an area where you can have an increased risk. It so happens my daughter's an immunologist at the University of Minnesota. She is 4 months pregnant, and she's caring for the H1N1 infected women whose children are unborn child is about to be born. So I can empathize with your concerns completely. And the fact of the matter is there are those risk factors that we don't know. In terms of needing two shots, yes, you're going to need two shots. You may have some limited protection within 10 to 14 days of the first shot, but it really is going to take the second shot. So just that system is going to be a nightmare. Remember, we're going to be administering seasonal flu. We're going to be administering two doses of this vaccine, and I think this is an important issue. Let me just say one last comment on this issue, though, because I know you'll be hearing more about this later. I actually sit in, I think, a very unique perspective because I was there when the first call was made in January of 1977 about the issue around this flu vaccine and the issue of the 1976 situation. Our group actually did the early work on Guillain-Barré syndrome associated with the 1976 flu vaccine. I'm a senior author in a major publication that actually definitively looked at what the risk was. And we did find a risk of about 1 in 100,000 people of the 45 million people that got swine flu vaccine. I want to allay any fears. The steps that basically led to that are not steps that are there today, meaning that there has been no shortcut in this vaccine whatsoever. And just as with the seasonal flu vaccine, which we've demonstrated over and over again its safety, and more importantly, how it can save lives, I have absolute confidence in the vaccine that we're producing today. You'll hear others to the contrary. It's hypothetical. It's theoretical. When you're sitting at the bedside of somebody that dies, that's not hypothetical or theoretical. That's what I have to deal with. And I will tell you that I hope that we're not derailed from what I think is going to be a very, very important program that's going to save lots of lives. By scare stories that it could be. And I have complete and utter confidence in the vaccine supply system that we have today. My big concern, it won't be enough fast enough.
Representation?
Yeah, thanks. I don't know if you're the, the question is this. When people, I've had, you know, some friends that were diagnosed this last spring with, they don't know, I suppose it was the H1N1 because they didn't get tested, but then there's treatment that you can get when you go to the doctor, whatever, some kind of flu medicine that you get.
Yes.
And then some of them were also, that was prescribed for family members as well. And I don't know, and there's been some debate, some insurance companies are covering the treatment for family members, some aren't. So they'll cover it for the sick person, but not for the immediate family. And I was just wondering if you had any knowledge or comments on the medical efficacy of that kind of, I guess, it's prophylactic treatment with that.
Right. Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. In fact, there are very effective antiviral drugs for this influenza. When I say effective, they're based on other studies of influenza viruses. We haven't had detailed long-term studies on this virus, but we have no reason to think it's acting any differently and therefore it'd be effective. There are two ways to use these drugs. One is as treatment. Treatment requires very rapid identification of the case. If you're going to really have any impact, you need to get the drug on board quickly. And so that, in fact, we've tried to target that. As you know, there is a national strategic stockpile, which will be made available. It has been made available already for treatment of sick people, and we need to identify that early. There is no drug available, per se, when I say per se, through the stockpile, but some companies have bought drugs, and others in personal health plan activities have actually used the drug for what we call prophylaxis, or meaning if I take it now one pill a day instead of two pills a day for treatment, I may actually be able to prevent from ever getting infected. And again, we have data showing that it is effective, and it can reduce the occurrence of infection in people. But that uses up a lot of drug quickly. And so the question is, when you have a rare drug, or I should say rare in the sense it's not readily available for all of us, treatment is clearly where we want to target it right now. The second piece of this is, of course, like any other infectious agent, resistance becomes a problem. And this past seasonal flu year, we ran into a resistant strain with one of the two seasonal flu strains, where virtually all these isolates, all the illness in these people came from resistant strains and almost rendered the drug useless. And so we want to be very sparing about this. We don't want to use this willy-nilly, with the idea we're giving Mother Nature and evolution just more opportunities to evolve this kind of resistance in this if, in fact, we don't need to. So I think the final answers aren't there. Again, I'm sure the health department folks will want to comment on this because they'll be at the front and center issue of the strategic national stockpile release of this drug. The bottom line, we just want to save lives. And so the drug will play an important role there, but how it will be paid for in terms of private sector, et cetera, I can't comment on that.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Osterholm, I know we're going to hear from the Department of Health, and I think from them we'll get a better sense of what to expect in the months ahead in a concrete way. But you were talking about some systemic issues from your perspective, and I'm wondering if you would have advice for us about ways that if you were the king, you would address those systemic issues.
Representative, boy, I wish you'd asked me this about 8 years ago and had me before the committee and I gave you the plan. I wrote a paper that was published in 2005 on what could we do to get ready for the next pandemic. And the thesis was it couldn't be any A plus B plus C plus miracle stuff. It had to be real doable stuff. And I had begged at that time that we would have invested much more into our vaccine development and research infrastructure so that we could deal with a modern vaccine that could be produced in large quantities quickly and protect against a lot of strains of influenza. I still believe that's the case. Just to put this into perspective, I got in a heck of a lot of trouble, and I think it might have been at this table, back in 1985 when I testified then as state epidemiologist and said that I did not believe we'd see an effective AIDS vaccine in my lifetime. And the next day, the Star Tribune royally took me over the coals for that naysayer status that I guess I've come to be known by. And I stick by that in my career. I think I will leave this profession without ever seeing an effective HIV vaccine just based on what we knew. Now, contrast that with I am convinced that we can have a universal influenza vaccine that can protect against all the 154 strains that could be given once every 10 years and protect the world from a pandemic. But we just haven't taken we haven't made the commitment to get there. You know, we kind of wanted to get to the moon, but we didn't. And so I think that that's not something that the Minnesota State Legislature can make happen, but if collectively enough of us as citizens of this country and citizens of the world said, we're going to get to the moon on this one, we're not going to have any more influenza pandemic, that could have happened. That's my wish, and I still believe that hopefully we'll learn from this war against flu virus, we don't want any more wars, and that we will do the research and the work to develop a universal vaccine for influenza, and that will basically get us there. I think the second thing, let me just point out, in this country, we all know it's been an economically very hard time. No one is in this room to say that we should be spending money willy-nilly. But in the past year, 10,000 public health workers in this country have lost their jobs. I only tell you that not because I'm asking for sympathy, but know that the system that you're overlaying all this work on is a system that's in tatters right now. And that, you know, it's kind of one of those things you can't go out and hire firemen, you know, the minute the fire alarm comes in. You either got to have them or you don't. And so I think ongoing infrastructure issues are huge. And I believe that Minnesota, because of their ability to get money from outside of the standard state funding, I mean, because of their excellence and because of their reputation, they have brought in some of the most funds in public health of any state health department in the country from outside of state government. I think we're going to be in better shape here, but I can tell you across the country right now, it is going to be a severe challenge using the public health system to both respond to the disease in terms of surveillance and follow-up as well as administer vaccine, and that's going to be a heck of a challenge. Thank you.
Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Ms. Lane. Doctor, I have a question about the, I want to just bring it up and ask again on my grandchildren will be receiving then three shots. They will have the flu shot and then the next injection of the H1N1, which is a series of two. So there would be three injections then.
Representative, yes, that's the case. They'll get three injections, and depending on how the seasonal flu vaccine is going to be rolled out, and you'll hear more about that, they may be given simultaneously with the first shot. Hopefully some of that will not overlap, but that's all going to be determined yet. So, yes, you need three injections.
And then those of us who are 65 and older will get just the flu shot that we get already and will not need the H1N1 injection?
Let me just say, first of all, there are categories of older populations that may be eligible for this depending on underlying health problems, okay? Not everyone over 65 is protected. And I wish we knew who you were. You know, if we could line you up and say, you, and you, get out, we need to give you vaccine, the rest of you are fine. We don't have that luxury. So there are going to be some people that will be overlaid that we will see some of the morbidity and mortality in those over 65. We've already seen that. So, but on a whole, from a population standpoint, many, many more people born before 1957 are protected against this than those born after 1957.
And then my last question, the nursing home residents that I've cared for many years and continue to, will they get all three injections routinely then?
I'm going to leave that for the health department to answer that one because I don't know what the actual plan is for that, but I don't believe that they will all be getting three injections. Surely everyone should get the seasonal flu injection, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you, Dr. Osterholm. And with that, we'll move to the...
Thank you very much.
Health. Dr. Ruth Linfield and Aggie Leiser.
I
Mr. Chair, committee members. My name's Ruth Linfield, and I am the state epidemiologist at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm the medical director of the Infectious Disease Division. And I really appreciate the opportunity today to talk with you about novel H1N1, what the experience has been in Minnesota, and what our plans are in the upcoming months. I'm going to begin by discussing what our experience has been, and then some thoughts about what we are concerned about in the fall. And Dr. Osterholm really, I think, set the stage very well. And Aggie Lighthouser will go into specific details about our plan, and both of us clearly are very interested in answering any questions that you may have. So Dr. Osterholm has already mentioned this, and many of you do know that we do have seasonal outbreaks every year with influenza, and the circulating strains are an H1 strain, H1N1, H3N2, and B influenza viruses, and every year there is a seasonal vaccine that is made based on the circulating viral strains. And as Dr. Osterholm mentioned, there is a mismatch of the H3N2 this year. Influenza, routine garden variety seasonal influenza, is not a benign infection. It's associated with 36,000 deaths each year and with over 200,000 hospitalizations. Every year, we have deaths in Minnesota, including deaths in previously healthy children. Sometimes it's due to the influenza strain. Sometimes it's due to bacterial superinfection, particularly with Staphylococcus aureus. Most of the deaths due to seasonal influenza, however, occur in the elderly, particularly folks that are 65 and older have the highest case fatality rate due to seasonal influenza. This is in contrast to what I'm going to tell you about novel H1N1 influenza. Most of the hospitalizations due to seasonal influenza are in folks 65 and older. This also is in contrast to what I'm about to tell you. The transmissibility of this novel virus is thought to be similar to or more than seasonal influenza. What we experienced in the United States this past spring and summer is a severity that is similar to seasonal influenza. However, the cases were primarily in a younger age group. Underlying conditions increase the risk for severe disease, including hospitalization, intensive care, and death, particularly asthma, pregnancy, particularly the combination of a pregnant woman with asthma, was a very severe risk factor. Other respiratory conditions, it turns out obesity was found to be a major risk factor for severe disease with this new strain. Diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, neurological diseases, other underlying conditions, also risk factors. Attack rates are thought to be about 25% in schools and 20 to 40% in households, so very transmissible. As of right now, according to CDC, the median age is 12. The median age of hospitalized cases, 20, and the median age of H1N1 cases that have been confirmed is only 37. In Minnesota, we have, do you have a question?
Yeah, just a quick, yeah. What does attack rate mean?
Attack rate means if you have a population or a group of people and someone's infected, what proportion of the contacts are going to become infected?
So if you have a school school that has 100 people, you'd expect 25 to become infected?
You might. If there's a 25% attack rate, right, that's going to be dependent a bit upon some conditions. And I should say that some of these data are preliminary. And so if you have a younger group of kids, say, 5 and under, carry more virus in their saliva, they have closer contact, they probably have a higher attack rate than older kids.
Okay, thanks.
So in Minnesota, we have 253 hospitalized cases to date. 18 of them have been pregnant women. The median age of our hospitalized cases is 12, so a bit younger than the national average. The range has been from 0 to 91, so we have had older folks who had severe disease and who have been hospitalized, including a death in a very elderly person, but we had two other deaths in children. One was in a child that had underlying conditions. The other was in a previously well child who developed influenza and then developed a very severe bacterial infection on top of that. The majority of our hospitalizations, 70%, have been in people under 25. And that is remarkable because, as I showed you before, for seasonal influenza, very different picture. Median length of stay in the hospital has been 3 days. 12% of those hospitalized have required intensive care. This is an important statistic to keep in mind as I tell you about what we're concerned about for the fall in terms of the impact on the healthcare system. We have seen individuals hospitalized.
I think we have a question from Representative Murphy before we go on.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thanks, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. You said your data is preliminary?
Yes.
So I just want to make sure that this is the data that we should be concentrating on in terms of our planning purposes. Your planning, what you're telling us, this is reliable.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. When I say preliminary, it's because we are dealing with an ongoing outbreak. And as we get more cases, it may be that the median age will change. I'm not expecting big changes at this point in time. Influenza viruses change, and there's certainly a possibility that it could become more severe, and there could be a bigger impact in other age groups. In terms of planning, we are using this information, which tells us that currently this strain is impacting a younger age group. So I had mentioned that many have an underlying condition, particularly asthma. We were hit hardest in the semi-county metropolitan area this past spring and early summer, with more than 80% of our hospitalized cases occurring there. This is a graph showing you how novel H1N1 came into our community. It's a graph of hospitalized cases. The blue on the graph is seasonal influenza A, the green is seasonal influenza B, and the red is novel H1N1. And what is really remarkable is usually what we have is this peak that occurs in the late fall, winter, early spring months, as Dr. Osterholm mentioned. But what we saw here was in April, we began to get cases. These are all hospitalized individuals, so represents really the tip of the iceberg. But you can see we peaked in June, and that is really, really unusual for influenza. So we're talking a bit about planning, and that's what we really have to think about very carefully. There are a couple of scenarios that are worth considering. One is, it is certainly possible that this novel H1N1 strain will become more virulent. That has happened in past pandemics. There was a mild strain that came in that preceded a much more virulent novel strain in 1918. And influenza viruses, surprise us. We cannot predict them, and so we have to be prepared for the possibility of change. This could result in increased hospitalizations, increased deaths. We do think that in any event, there will be a very large burden of disease in younger age groups. And this is going to impact our society in many, many ways. Even if this strain does not become more virulent, just the overall burden of influenza is going to be quite dramatic. When we have three seasonal strains, including one that we know ahead of time is going to be a mismatch, plus this novel strain, we do think, even under the best of circumstances, we will have an increased burden of illness, and there will be an overwhelming of the healthcare system. And I'm going to show you some numbers on what that may look like. So if we project that 30% of the population may become infected with a novel strain, that's about 1.5 million. And if half of those people go to their doctor for outpatient care, that is 770,000. Now, depending on how severe the strain is, we might expect that between 2 and 20% of those who seek outpatient care will require inpatient care. And that's where these numbers get really scary, 15,000 to 172,000. And if 15% require ICU care, then that's between 2,250 and close to 26,000. Just think about that for a minute, 26,000. I showed you that we had about 12% of our predominantly younger, healthier population with H1N1 requiring ICU care. So 50%, including folks who are older who have underlying conditions, I think is a reasonable estimate. Depending on the strain, we might expect between 0.2 to 2% of folks who are ill dying. Now, right now, we are thinking that the strain is similar to seasonal influenza, and we estimate a case fatality rate of less than 0.5%. However, if it became more severe, and if we had the burden of seasonal flu with a mismatch on top of it, in fact, we could have many deaths. And that's something, again, that we need to be very concerned about.
Okay, excuse me again, Representative Eason.
Thanks. Can you just go back to that last slide? So where do the, can you just give a little sense of where those numbers come from, like the 30% of the population? And
right, okay, sure. So for seasonal influenza, we estimate by many, many years of observation, somewhere along the lines of 20% of the population getting infected. For a novel strain, we estimate could be between 20 and 40%. So many mathematical modelers have chosen 30%.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, so a question has been raised about novel H1N1 vaccine.
Could interrupt
yes,
once again.
Please.
Representative Lafler has a question.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our state epidemiologists. Do you know what our current ICU bed capacity is? Those numbers are pretty amazing.
They are pretty amazing. I will let Aggie Lighthouser address that question.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I believe our ICU capacity is somewhere in the neighborhood of 12,000 beds, but I will need to check for sure on the accuracy of that number. And I can get back to the committee. Mm-hmm.
And Representative Huttling.
Just a comment. If this does not relate to the flu, but if a 747 happened to crash at the Minneapolis airport and all 450 people survived but were injured, we couldn't handle them in the Twin Cities. We'd have to ship many of those people to Rochester and St. Cloud and Duluth because we don't have the extra beds right now for 454 people.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
I
overstated by a zero. Sorry, it's more like 1,200. But I will still check on that number for sure. 12,000 is too many zeros.
The point is that we have a concern here. Please go on.
Okay, really, when you're dealing with an infectious disease, it really the best thing you can do is prevent it. And so vaccine is really our best tool in our toolbox. And we truly are fortunate that companies working together with CDC, which was able to come out with a seed virus, that folks were able to ramp up and to have a vaccine, and we're optimistic that we will have vaccine in October. We do think that people will likely require two doses. There are studies that are going on right now looking at the immune response to the vaccine, but most experts think that two doses will be required to have enough protection. There have been some questions raised about how we will use the vaccine. We anticipate that the vaccine is going to come in batches and that we will roll it out as we get it. And so we are going to prioritize healthcare workers. We are going to prioritize individuals who are at very high risk for severe disease. And this will include pregnant women. It will include young children. It will include people taking care of young children because children under 6 months of age cannot be vaccinated. They don't mount a good response. And if there is adequate vaccine, we would like in this initial batch of vaccine to vaccinate folks up until the age of 24. If there is not adequate vaccine, we will at least vaccinate young children and then children up through 18 who have a high-risk condition. Following that, as we get in more vaccine, we will then vaccinate older adults that have high-risk conditions, but adults who are under 65, because as Dr. Osterholm mentioned, we think that about a third of those individuals do have some kind of cross-protecting antibody, and they have been hit much less hard than the younger group. But we do anticipate that we will eventually have enough vaccine for the whole population so that we do clearly plan to vaccinate anyone who would like to be vaccinated.
And we have a question from Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, or probably Ms. Lighthouser, maybe you could best answer this, but the doctor, Osterholm, talked about that we wouldn't have enough vaccine immediately, that it is coming, and hopefully we will have, but also he indicated that there won't be enough equipment or supplies. And I have a question about the respirators. Being a healthcare worker, and then seeing the news of and you know the pictures of folks that last year wearing the masks, and wondering for healthcare workers, is it the N95 respirator mask that has a tight seal to the face that you recommend, and is that the recommendation of the health department? That's my first question, and the second question, of course, is do we have enough of them for all of our healthcare workers, and will we be able to supply those?
Madam Chair, Representative, will tag team this one.
Okay.
So I'll talk a little bit about the use of N95s and surgical masks, and then Ms. Lighthizer is going to discuss what we have stockpiled.
Thank you.
Okay, so The issue of infection control is one that is being looked at very carefully at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and actually this week the Institute of Medicine is meeting about it. There have been a number of guidelines that have been issued, guidance by the World Health Organization, as well as guidelines by the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, as well as the Minnesota Department of Health. And CDC is awaiting some discussion of this guidance by the Institute of Medicine, and we'll be reviewing it. But what those organizations have indicated is that the approach toward influenza in a healthcare setting, and a healthcare setting is quite different than just general interaction, is that infection is spread via droplets. Now, if it is very small droplets, and under some certain conditions, such as intubating a patient, there may be very small droplets that can be spread, in which case you would want a tight seal and N95. And that situation is called an aerosol-generating procedure. For many healthcare interactions, we think that a surgical mask is adequate because the type of interaction you're having is such that you would have protection of your mucous membranes of your nose and your mouth against droplets. But there are cases where we think that an N95 would be useful. This, again, is an area that people are looking at carefully. CDC initially came out with guidance about using N95 for all healthcare interactions. That is not what is done for seasonal influenza, and so it's an area of great discussion. Our approach is one that follows the World Health Organization and the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America. So we're looking at surgical masks. We also think it may be prudent if you are taking care of a family member at home, because if there is a healthcare surge and we can't have everyone in the hospital, it would be prudent to put on a surgical mask. The other advantage of a surgical mask is it functions like a catcher's mitt. So if the person who is sick can tolerate a surgical mask, that is optimal because then their secretions are being contained. And that really makes it a much safer situation. So that's something that we recommend in the healthcare setting and in other settings, if an infected person can wear a surgical mask. You should also remember that that is one of many tools that people can use to decrease the transmission of influenza. The others are washing hands very carefully, and in a healthcare setting, using gloves, using gowns, using, if you're afraid of splashes, a shield that covers your eyes or goggles that cover your eyes.
Let me interrupt Dr. Linfield, and perhaps some of this can be conveyed to healthcare workers in your dealings with them, and I'm going to ask you concern for time that I would ask you one more question about the vaccines and then ask you to move quickly to Dr. To Aggie Lighthizer. But my question about vaccines, are they going to be mandatory?
No, vaccines are not going to be mandatory. We also are hopeful that we'll have the seasonal influenza vaccine in the beginning of September, so we can start that going before we get novel H1N1 in. And we are really very much going to encourage people to be vaccinated, but we are not going to mandate vaccination.
Thank you. If there's something else you can skip, we can move on.
I do want to mention one last thing is because of the concern for Guillain-Barré syndrome, we are going to do surveillance for Guillain-Barré syndrome. This is something that we want to keep an eye on. We also will be looking carefully for other potential adverse effects. There is a baseline of Guillain-Barré that occurs, so there will be cases that occur, but it will be important, I think, to detect quickly if we are seeing an increase. I will just quickly mention that there are antivirals. There are different classes of antivirals. The neuraminidase inhibitors, oseltamivir and zanamivir, also
known by their trade names, Tamiflu and Relenza, are in the state stockpile. We have an 80% of oseltamivir, 20% zanamivir. Zanamivir is orally inhaled, so it can be a bit more challenging to administer. And we are concerned about potential resistance for oseltamivir. Dr. Osterholm discussed a bit about antiviral drugs, so I won't go into that other than we have seen resistance depending on the flavor of influenza that you have, and that is something that we need to keep an eye out for.
On that use for to prevent disease and expose, do you have any, are there any guidelines the Department of Health has about
Yes,
that?
We do. We have guidelines on our website, and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also has guidelines on their website.
Thanks.
So in addition to vaccines and antiviral agents, community measures are extremely important in decreasing transmission, and depending on how severe the strain is, we may recommend more significant measures. Currently, it is extremely important that sick people stay home, and it's really important to get this message out throughout the state and to be sure that employers understand that people need to take this seriously. They need to stay home when they're sick. This is a very transmissible virus. If their children are home, they need to let the parents stay home to take care of the children so the children don't go back into school and infect other people. If it were a more severe strain, we might recommend that household members stay home. We would recommend increasing social distancing, and we might recommend that schools, child care programs close or public gatherings be canceled. Again, that would only be something that we would do if the circumstances became pretty dire. At this point, I will turn it over to Aggie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Ms. Lighthizer, if you could kind of compact your study to the most urgent for the public to actually be aware of.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer. I'm the Director of Emergency Preparedness for the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we are doing to be ready for the fall and to expand our response if it's needed. We're looking ahead to a potentially moderate or severe pandemic. The priority activities that have been identified, particularly in collaboration with multiple partners, local health departments, healthcare providers, other state agencies, other local agencies, and the private sector as well. Epidemiology and laboratory surveillance, Dr. Winfield has talked about that some, making sure that we are connected to and working with other international groups and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, providing advice and support to our clinical labs, investigating cases, making sure we have good information by which we make decisions about intervention or prevention. We talked a bit about the vaccination program, and there's a lot of issues in getting us ready to do that. This will be a combination private sector and public sector. We'll need to understand where the vaccine is going to be going in Minnesota, who has it, do we have it in the right places. As we've talked about the targeted priority groups, we may have too much vaccine in one place and not enough in another. There's a lot of communication and tracking issues. We will be using the Minnesota Immunization Information Connection, our immunization registry, as one of the ways to track who's gotten what vaccine, and so that we can help people make sure they have the right dose of vaccine that they're getting. Antiviral medications, we do have a stockpile of medications. We have about 1.2 million between the state and the federal stockpile available to us, making sure, again, that it's getting to the right place, tracking it, watching for adverse effects. Do we see an impact on the course of disease? Dr. Winfield and Dr. Osterholm talked a bit about community mitigation, making sure, again, that we are consistent with what's happening in other parts of the country, that we are not more aggressive or less aggressive than our neighbors. The public ability to manage the information, we've already have seen that as the guidance and the advice has changed, it's an adjustment for people.
on how they understand what it is we're asking them to do. But we also need to be ready to act quickly. We've talked about, right now we are seeing still a mild disease. We may be moving to a more severe, where we have more people needing more intensive care, more people dying, and we may need to take quicker action to reduce interaction among public groups. Public and private, or maybe partner communication is a better choice of words, making sure that we can get information out quickly, that the variable media attention, we've had a lot of attention, we have a little attention, we have some attention. What are the messages that we want to get out from the public health sector? How do we help that, again, the changing information? Our website has a lot of information on it. There's some materials available in multiple languages. That's an important challenge for us, is to make sure that we have the information to for the people who need the information. And the continuing challenge is too much and not enough. And we get that, we can get that from the same person in the same day. And I think we all feel sometimes that we're getting too much information, but it's not exactly targeted to me. That's one of our challenges. Medical surge issues have come up a bit. Some of our work there is to be prepared for the surge for outpatient and emergency rooms. Some of the discussion that you heard already about the number of people who might be sick and want medical care, helping physicians at the regional and local level think about how do we adjust care so that we can see a larger number of people very quickly. Updating plans for alternate care sites in the same manner, we may see a lot more people needing hospital care. So limited resources, we may not have enough staff. How do we use changes in how we approach the use of staff? But now, at the risk of my earlier number challenge, I'll give you a different number. We have, at this point, regionally, state, and federal combined available to Minnesota 5.5 million N95 masks available in the state. So as the guidance adjusts and changes, that might be a useful change. And I have an updated, just in time, piece of information. We have 1,079 adult intensive care unit beds and 123 pediatric intensive care unit beds.
Mm-hmm.
So my apologies for miscommunicating that. Training for healthcare providers. If we are adjusting our care, adjusting the way we are using oxygen or our medications, making sure that people who might be trying to do different kinds of work, that they are ready and prepared to do that. And again, I mentioned earlier coordinating with border states and Canada. There's a lot of activity and a lot of work that's being done at the local health department level as well. They're critically important to managing the care, the planning, the vaccination programs. The department also has a lot of attention to making sure our priority services continue, that the WIC program, who many people rely on, continues to operate, that we are still investigating and following up on foodborne diseases, that our drinking water is safe, some of those kinds of things. And I think at this point we would stand for questions.
All right, and Representative Bunn has a question. Thank you. To follow up on Representative Lane's question earlier about whether these vaccinations would be mandatory for anyone, and I believe the answer is no. I believe state statute, at least for adults, prevents it from being mandatory. But in terms of the case of children, when there's been discussion, although you really haven't mentioned it today much, but there's been discussion that may take place, some of the effect is through schools, and we haven't seen that in a long time. I remember that as a child, that we may see school-based vaccination more than we've seen in the past. Currently, to attend school, there's a list of vaccinations children are required to have for entry into school, only a few opt-outs for religious and other kinds of reasons, I think, that exist. In this instance, is this going to be treated in any way like those currently required vaccinations for school, or this will be a different category which truly will continue to be an optional rather than mandatory, even though highly encouraged for certain age groups of children and children with specific conditions?
We have a vaccine advisory committee, and so this is something that we'll be discussed at that level. And I think what one thing we want to do, we don't like to mandate things. I think it's really important that parents understand the potential risk of infection and the benefits of vaccination. And so I think we certainly have to do our utmost to get that information out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I mentioned, we'll discuss it with the advisory committee.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And with that, I thank you for coming today. I am assured that we have a good public health response in the state of Minnesota from my talk with you previously. And now, thank you. We have Catherine Berg and Greg Schmidt that would like to make some comments, and I hope that we can do it in about 2 minutes. Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gregory Schmidt. I'm president of Minnesota Natural Health Legal Reform Project. It's often said that those who don't learn from history are bound to repeat it. Given the record with flu vaccines generally, which range from total misses to inconsequential, and the specific example which has been spoken about earlier from 1976, where, to quote the Minneapolis Star Tribune, the vaccine program killed more people than the virus itself, perhaps the more balanced and calm approach would be a more helpful strategy. Since the 5 full U.S. clinical trials won't be completed until April of next year at the earliest, according to the National Institutes of Health estimate, the vaccine that is being made for distribution this fall under a fast-track protocol is in effect planning on using the general population as its test ground. We find this deplorable. Worse yet, the recommendation of vaccination of pregnant women first, when no testing has included pregnant women and the impact on their babies, is unconscionable. To make matters even worse, if that is possible, it appears that the test vaccine is not even identical chemically or with the same ingredients as the product being readied for the fall schedule. I don't think I'd be too eager to fly in a plane which had never been tested as an assembly before takeoff. Fear, apprehension, lack of factual information, force, etc., is not a public health policy. Panic can create illness almost by itself. We urge this committee and the Minnesota legislature to ensure retention of the statutory right to refuse mandatory testing and or mandatory vaccination for all Minnesota citizens. Self-shielding, self-isolation, quarantine, or preferred shielding are superior methods of disease control. The vitality of the body cells, a healthy lifestyle, and a healthy immune system are the basis of real immunity. Good judgment comes from experience, and a lot of that experience comes from bad judgment. Thank you.
And next. My name is Diane Miller, and I'm here on behalf of the National Health Freedom Coalition as their legal director and also representing Minnesota Legal Reform Project. We work to help people have information so that they can make health care choices. That's what our work is about, and we also support a lot of complementary and alternative health care approaches. We're very grateful for the government's preparedness, and I've been a part of a group called PandemicFluOnline.com. I'm an attorney licensed in Minnesota, but I'm also and also the drafter of the complementary and alternative medical statute that we have here, and I noticed Representative Boudreau is here that graciously carried that bill for us. We really care about parents and children and the elderly having information about what's going on. And a national group of us got together and put out PandemicFluOnline.com because we noticed that there was a lot of fear-mongering with information that was going out to the regular public and parents. And then there was also government things that weren't telling us everything we wanted to know. In fact, we really tried to get an ingredients roster of the actual thing they're testing right now, and they're just doing dosages. And when I was on MSNBC the other night, Dr. Fauci from the National Institute of Health said there won't be any adjuvants in the clinical trials, and there won't be any adjuvants given to children. And the adjuvants are really the The ingredient that has been attributed to Gulf War syndrome in the anthrax trials. So we're wanting more information. We're wanting to look at this very critically. We don't want to be a knee-jerk reaction. We want people to be informed. I think that the difference, we were also the drafters of the Minnesota statute that says that we reserve the right to refuse a treatment or vaccine during a pandemic, even in the face of martial law. And so we did not want that governor delegated, the power of the government delegated. We wanted an exemption to make sure that we were able to refuse treatment in the face of martial law. And we do have that in Minnesota, and in my national work, no other state has that exemption for compulsory vaccination for bioterrorism. But we do have a national model on pandemic flu online that we've created that all other states now are looking at to put into effect like Minnesota has. The question about that, though, is that in the case of a declared emergency, the laws are sometimes changing, and we wanted to make sure that parents don't ever have the experience where they have a child come home from school and say, by the way, Mom, I got my flu shot today. We want the same notices to come to parents. We want parents to think about it, to find out what the ingredients are, to make an informed decision about the flu pandemic and what they want to do in their family situation. And so we hope that Minnesota puts in place a form for exemptions and that our regular school reporting exemptions apply to any declared emergency. There's no actual form for that. But we have rigid laws about the school notices. We don't have any form laws for the bioterrorism situation or a pandemic. A couple other things. I noticed that the clinical trials on the fast track are they're studying healthy people, and there's a lot of people who have died that are not healthy, and we're wondering if they're doing clinical trials on a non-adjuvant vaccine, and then will they put the adjuvant in, like squalene, where the studies on squalene have the rats dragging their bodies from paralysis? So if they're going to add adjuvants, which it sounds like the government has ordered, I mean, not the government, but the manufacturers have ordered large doses of these adjuvants in their contracts, we want to know, and no one's giving the ingredient list. We want informed consent. We don't want to have people losing their jobs because they won't take a vaccine. The New York Nurses Association, New York just passed a law that says in the face of the pandemic, you have to get your vaccine if you're working in a hospital situation. The Nurses Association tried very hard to lobby against that because there are some nurses that use other alternatives. I mean, think of all the people that do choose not to have vaccines or use homeopathic remedies or whatever they do. So the other thing is in rest homes, we want to make sure that the rest home residents always have their legal guardian have the same information that parents would have, because a lot of times in rest homes you have a conversation with a person and you're really not sure if they understood or not, and sometimes these, you know, you're the legal guardian, you come into the rest home and they say, I got my flu shot today. Or a vulnerable adult, I got my flu shot today. And you haven't even been notified. There's a lot of that happening in the handicapped, mentally handicapped world. So I guess that what I would like to represent for Minnesota Legal Reform Project and the National is that we really want as many safeguards put in place, forms, notices, information, a website where people can know not what they want. Like if they have a question, can they get the answer to that question? And I said again, I really appreciate the preparedness and I'm appreciative of all the emergency teams, and we hope that we can keep our immune systems really strong before we have to do this. But vaccines are not the only way that parents keep their kids safe, and so we want the focus to be on parent information. Thanks.
Thank you. And could we ask you to be very, very quick with your time?
Absolutely. My name is Catherine Berg, and I wear a lot of hats, but here I'm here today as a parent. And just to really encourage the continued use of choice on behalf of parents. When Dr. Linfield was up here, she suggested that if the flu became really serious, they may recommend more significant measures in schools. And I don't know what more significant measures means, but it kind of put a little fear in my heart when she said that. And there's a vaccine advisory committee, and we're not sure who's on that or, you know, what they're interested in. But I have chosen to use the Minnesota exemption for vaccine, for school vaccines, and my children have not been vaccinated. And by the way, they're very healthy and have never come down with anything. When they do get sick, I use homeopathy for them. But I believe that parents should always be able to make a choice for their children, even in the case of some emergency declaration on the part of the state or the federal government. I'm concerned, as Diane was, about the fast-tracking of the vaccine. There is, in fact, not even a compensation program from the federal government. It is not funded for this vaccine. And the drug companies have no liability whatsoever if this vaccine doesn't work. So if somebody gets injured from it, I guess it's just too bad. And so I'm concerned about that as a parent as well and as a healthcare practitioner. And I do, as a parent, want to know ahead of time if there's going to be a bunch of nurses who come into the school and say, all right, everybody line up and let's give your vaccinations. Maybe this is one of the more significant measures she's referring to. I don't know. And then the final thing I think is important that hasn't been brought up yet is, so we're going to be giving everybody a seasonal flu vaccine, and then we're going to be giving them two swine flu vaccines, which I don't believe the swine flu is going to be made available in a mercury-free version. And so that means we're going to be getting three doses of mercury in this season's flu vaccination program. And the state of Minnesota has told us over and over again over the years as we've tried to pass legislation passing a preference for mercury-free vaccines, that it's going to be out of the vaccines, it's going to be out, it's going to be out. And we just like you as legislators to insist that they stick to their word and get the mercury out of vaccines in Minnesota. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's problematic. And we would like to see you as legislators make them stick to their word and get the mercury out of the vaccine.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for coming today. In regular time, I think I can just make some comments to some of the things that has been brought up. And one is that I believe there is a mercury-free version of the H1N1 shot. And you will know the Department of Health is planning to put a website specifically with all the information on an ongoing basis out there. So there will be a website for the public to keep up on details with. And, yes, it's always good to keep your immune system healthy, although we know that sometimes that can actually work against young people when they have a strong immune dysfunction reaction. And I do believe that we have some very critically acclaimed and critical actions being taken by both the health department and people nationally that are keeping a very clear eye on this because of the consequences they have to. If there was anything that happened, there would be an investigation afterwards, like there was a 9/11 commission to see who didn't do what when. So you can rest assured that people are really up on this, and you can keep informed on the website. So thank you for coming.
Okay, well, and thank you, Representative Lane, for pulling all that together. I thought that was really helpful, and I know that you have a lot more information to get out about this as well as it. But thank you for all your work on that, and everybody for coming. So we're going to go on, Representative Kahn, to the hospital-acquired infections reporting legislation that you introduced. And it's, you know, we're going to go quite clearly past 4 o'clock here. So, but if we could try to do this one in about a half an hour or so, that would be great. And there's a lot of people that want to testify. But
okay.
Thanks for coming and for waiting.
But thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I just listening to your admonition, I won't take any time at all with this. I will just say that this started because I put in a bill in 2007, which was incorporated into the House bill, which set up a reporting system on hospital infections. I then tried to find it on the website and couldn't find it, so I put in another bill this past March, House File 1759, which kind of said, we really meant it, really do it. In which case, the point of putting that bill in turned out that the effect of the previous one was that we were in the process of doing it. And so the information was first being collected, and the first report, I think, will appear on the website in September. So I'm looking forward to that. I just want to call the members' attention to one additional piece of information that I put out, and I guess, think it's been distributed and it's also been out there. It's a New York Times op-ed, not by a health person, but by Paul O'Neill, who is the Secretary of the Treasury from 2001 to 2002. And it has, the title of it is Healthcare's Infectious Losses, and it has the cost of what we're being, of what hospital infections are costing us. And, you know, I, as you know, I'm not on this committee.
It's being distributed right
okay,
now.
Okay, great. But one of the things I would like us, I would like this committee to look at consistently when we're looking at the kinds of things we want to do in healthcare is the kinds of things which are most likely to bring increased cost effectiveness. So with that, and with that in front of you, I look forward as much as you do to hearing the rest of the people talking today.
Thank you.
So thank you for holding this.
Sure. Welcome to the committee. And just identify yourself for the record when you get the chance.
Thank you. My name is Sue Stout. I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Kahn for taking a leadership role on the issue of hospital reporting of infections. And I'd like to thank the committee for taking the time to talk about this issue today. There'll be several testifiers that are following me who are really the experts in describing the activities to date related to complying with the two laws, but I wanted to just give you a really quick overview. In 2007, there was legislation passed which directed hospitals to report and display on the Minnesota Hospital Association website hospital measures for hospital-acquired infections that are published by the National Quality Forum. In addition, in 2007, there was a law directing every hospital in Minnesota to have an MRSA control program that met the Minnesota Department of Health guidelines, and that we needed to be in complete compliance with those guidelines by January 2009. The goal of our activities have been, number one, to increase transparency, number two, to improve quality, and number three, to prevent infections. And really, we've been working on all those equally hard. The approach that we've taken at the Hospital Association to this issue has been to try to partner up with those who can really help us to do a good job in meeting those goals. So really, the first partnership has been to try to connect up with experts in the field, scientists who really understand infection control. And that would be APIC and the Minnesota Department of Health. So we've been connecting with those two groups to assist, as well as another group that we wanted to connect with are consumers. And the main reason for connecting up with consumers is, as we try to achieve transparency, we want to be sure that whatever we do is really helpful. So we want the consumer voice involved in the work that we're doing. Another group that we've been trying to connect to has been quality measurement organizations, and that's what brought us to the door of Stratus Health. So that's why the team that you're going to see in front of you includes APIC, the Minnesota Department of Health, the Consumer Worker Coalition, and Stratus, as well as Hospital Association. What's coming up again, we'll cover the real details. One thing I do feel I have to remind you of, given the presentation that we had just a moment ago from the Health Department, should the pandemic flu issues become severe, and that's possible, that will affect the amount of resources that we have to place into reporting on some of this other work. And I only mention that because We have only so many infection control practitioners available in the state, and we may have to move their efforts from working on this website and displaying this information to working on flu activities. We're hoping not. We're hoping we can do all the work that we need to do, but we're very worried about the number of people that we have who are infection control practitioners, and we want to be sensitive to their time. So with that, I'm going to hand it over here.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and the committee, my name is Michelle Farber, and I'm a registered nurse and board certified in infection control. I have over 25 years of experience and currently work as the infection control specialist at Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids. I was elected to serve on the board of directors as director of large for the Association for Professionals in Infection Control and Epidemiology, which we will refer to as APEC. Today, I'm here representing the Minnesota chapter. And as APEC, we are a nonprofit, multidisciplinary international organization representing more than 12,000 infection preventionists with over 300 APEC members in Minnesota. Our mission is to improve health and promote safety by reducing the risk of infection in patients and healthcare personnel. I would like to thank Representative Peason and committee members for holding this hearing and for allowing me the opportunity to speak on behalf of all my colleagues who work to prevent infections. Many are in the audience. I would also like to thank Representative Pahn, who introduced the first legislation in Minnesota on public reporting of healthcare associated infections, which I'm going to refer to as HAIs. Her support and attention to this issue is part of the reason why we're here today, and we applaud her for the commitment to patient safety, and we look forward to continuing to collaborate with stakeholders. Our work of preventing HAIs is critical because it saves patient lives and controls healthcare costs. To provide additional information on EPIC's mission, I have a short DVD here just to show you. Just to show you what our mission is as our national organization and local Minnesota members. APEC supports public reporting of hospital-acquired infections for two important reasons. First, consumers should be knowledgeable about and feel safe about the health care they receive. And second, by monitoring health HAIs, we can use this information in our hospital quality improvement programs to better prevent them. APEC Minnesota's involvement with the quality improvement programs to better prevent them. APEC Minnesota's involvement with the public reporting of HAIs began with the enactment of Chapter 147.
All 12,000 of us. A world without infection. Is it possible? Perhaps not. But we can do more than dream. And we do. All 12,000 of us. Every day. In urban medical centers and rural clinics. Around the corner. Or half a world away. We teach. You empower. You bring science to the bedside. And the schoolroom. And the nursing home. And the playing field. And countless other places. We are APEC. We have a story to tell. And you're going to. In a new way. With a new voice. Because a world without infection may be a dream. But it's our dream.
So APHIS Minnesota's involvement with public reporting of hospital-acquired infections began with the enactment of Chapter 147 in 2007, which requires that data should be collected by the Minnesota Hospital Association, or MHA, and Stratus Health in collaboration with infection control practitioners. Many of our members, including myself, with clinical and scientific expertise, were asked to participate in an advisory role with MHA, Stratus Health, and consumers to develop the system. The infection preventionists and committee members reviewed the 2008 NQF, or National Quality Forum's voluntary consensus standards for reporting hospital-acquired infections, to recommend appropriate measures for public reporting in Minnesota. Once these National Quality Forum validated measures were selected, data collection elements needed to be clearly specified, but the process was not as straightforward as it sounds. For example, one of the NQF endorsed best practices for the prevention of a respirator or ventilator-associated pneumonia is reporting the elevation of the patient's bed greater than 30 degrees. Committee members had to answer additional procedural questions. We had to determine if a visual assessment of elevating the head of the bed was acceptable or if written documentation was necessary. Which healthcare providers must document that the degree of head of bed elevation was correct? How often does the elevation need to be checked and documented in the chart? What are the medical contraindications that would prevent compliance with this measure, such as a patient's blood pressure being too low and that requires them to remain flat as part of their care, and how these contraindications are recorded in the chart and who had the authority to document them? Committee members also analyzed the scientific literature from the CDC and the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, as well as reviewing processes by other states in implementing HAI reporting legislation. After it was determined how the data should be collected, educational tools, handouts, and PowerPoints were developed for those who would be collecting and submitting the data in the hospital. Webinars and conference calls were held to allow for questions and answers, and infection preventionists continue to serve as resources for those who have questions on issues related to as they arise. It is our goal that by developing a statistically valid, high-quality, scientifically-based data collection system, we will find this data helpful in improving patient care at our own institution. APHIS members continue to be active participants in helping to determine how the sensitive data can best be displayed so it's useful for our consumers. As MHA will explain, meaningful data display is a very important process of this reporting procedure. Again, APHIS is grateful for this opportunity to speak to you today, and we look forward to continuing our collaboration with you. Representative Kahn, Minnesota Hospital Association, Minnesota Department of Health, Stratus Health, and Minnesota consumers by spreading knowledge about infection prevention and maintaining a reliable public reporting system that will help all of us work together to prevent HAI.
Thank you. My name is Mark Sonneborn. I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I am the Vice President of Information Systems. It's my job to help get all of these hospitals reporting into this website and to construct the website and to put it on the web. And I have it up here, and before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about what MHA has done to this point. Back in 2005, all of the ICUs in the state that treated patients that had ventilators went on a project to basically prevent ventilator-associated pneumonia, which is one of the most common types of infections for patients on ventilators. There is a bundle, and I'm going to use the word bundle here, of procedures that are shown to be evidence-based to prevent the or to reduce these infections, and there's, and we tried to get every ICU in the state to implement this bundle. This is now also one of the measures that is going to be up on our site in September, the compliance to the ventilator bundle. So back in 2005, well, we had a project, and all of the hospitals participated. Also, near that same time frame, in 2006, we partnered with the Minnesota Alliance for Patient Safety on the national campaign for saving 100,000 lives nationally. And again, the ventilator project was only one part of that, several other things part of that. You're going to hear about the 2007 law about MRSA, which again is that an infection out in the community that's drug resistant. And then we hosted training sessions for hospitals to help them implement those guidelines that came from the Department of Health. In terms of our reporting activities, since 2005, we've actually had a law on the books to have hospital information displayed publicly, and that's at this site. If you've not been there, the website is www.mnhospitalquality.org. We started out with heart failure, heart attack, pneumonia, added surgical care, and now we have infection reporting, and we also have patient satisfaction data on this website. So without further ado, I want to also say the 2007 law that Representative Kahn talked about was tied to the National Quality Forum. National Quality Forum is a multi-stakeholder group that helps to look at what measures should be publicly reported at the national level. We also use the NQF, I'm going to say NQF here, for our adverse event reporting. It's a very good process for getting multi-stakeholder input for what should be publicly reported. Okay, and we are taking our cue from the National Quality Forum of what should be reported on healthcare-associated infections. So I'm going to go a little bit to our website here, and I'm going to hit the button that says Compare Hospital, which you might be a little tough to see from here, but it'll get better. You see here, I'm going to choose just the metro hospitals, and then we have a section already on infection reporting. There's actually two of the measures that the NQF recommended were in our pipeline to be reported already, so we're already reporting on those. And those are the ones down here that are marked with the new button, and they have one has to do with cardiac surgery, and the other one has to do with appropriate care removal. I'm going to go ahead and choose that one, but while I'm choosing that, you can also see that the coming soon are four measures, and those have to do with surgical site infection rates for two procedures, then the central line infection prevention bundle, and the ventilator bundle that I said before. Another note here on the total knees, any type of surgery that involves an implant, and with total knee replacement involves an implant, you have to look back for 12 months. So if the surgery was today, it would still count as a surgical site infection if they were got an infection any time in the next 12 months. Now, what that does is cause a data time lag. So those that we're reporting on now, we won't be able to report for another 12 months. So anything that includes an implant, there's going to be a time lag in the reporting. So three of these four are coming on in September. The only one that's not is the total knee. And next Monday is the deadline for getting them in. So I'm going to go ahead. This is appropriate care removal. I'm creating a chart here on the fly, and this shows basically, here you have a yellow bar that shows the statewide average, a red bar that shows the regional average here in the metro, and then actual hospital results. I am going to click on Lakeview Memorial Hospital, which is here in Stillwater, which had got 100% on hair removal with 365 patients. When I click on this green bar, it shows me all of their infection measures versus the state average. So we're hopeful that we're going to use the same sort of scheme for the additional measures that we're going to be reporting here in September. But basically, this is our website. We're fairly proud of it, and we want to keep it going. One other note here. There is something that you may hear about NHSN, which is National Healthcare Safety Network. It's a database that the Centers for Disease Control puts forward, or CDC. And many other states have mandatory reporting to NHSN. We chose not to do that for two reasons. First of all, not all the NQF measures are reported through NHSN, so we were reporting more than what NHSN was taking. The second and probably more important thing is it's much more labor-intensive type of data collection. Every patient has to collect elements on and put it into their system, and it doesn't currently interface with hospitals' electronic surveillance system. So basically, hospitals that have electronic surveillance system would have to double enter everything. Now, CDC is working on this. We believe within the next 6 to 12 months that problem will be solved. And so at that point, we may look again at going to NHSN. So I wanted to, if that question came up, I wanted to sort of address that up front. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to our next speaker.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Janelle Sear, and I'm representative representing Stratus Health this afternoon. I'm a program manager there. Stratus Health is a nonprofit organization that leads collaboration and innovation in healthcare quality and safety. We've been in existence since 1971, so for 35 years we've been helping healthcare providers in Minnesota improve the care of their patients. We serve as the Minnesota Medicare Quality Improvement Organization. We've been involved in the Infection Reporting Advisory Committee by providing background information and expertise on some of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services measures, such as the surgical improvement care measures. Just a little background as far as the priority and focus for Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. They have been interested in surgical care improvement projects since about 2002. So as the Quality Improvement Organization for Minnesota, we have been working with hospitals in our state on various projects on the surgical improvement measures. We're currently working with a group of hospitals that have been identified by Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that need some assistance in improving their measures. So we started this project about a year ago, actually August 1st, 2008, and are working on measures. I believe you have some fact sheets. There's one with a table on the front that lists the surgical measures. So we are working with these hospitals on the measures. And actually, to date, all but one of these measures have reached 90% or above for these particular hospitals. Hospitals are currently reporting the same measures to Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services as they are for the Joint Commission at the current time. We are also currently working with hospitals on reducing healthcare-acquired methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus or MRSA infections. We're working with just a specific number of hospitals to assist them in reporting their MRSA, the methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, data into the National Healthcare Safety Network Registry, which Mark referred to. So we've been able to assist these hospitals in the registration and enrollment process and also data submission into this registry. And it has been a little bit challenging, but we've been able to help them do that. And we also will use the collected data and standardized protocols to help these hospitals reduce the infections in their hospitals. Thank you.
Can I just ask a quick question? The so the reporting for this is on outcome measures as opposed to numbers of infections. And is there any way to even measure that kind of?
Actually, some of the measures that the National Quality Forum has identified are what we call process measures. Did you do these five things to prevent an infection? And those are the ones actually that you see on the website right now. But some of the measures that are coming up in September and on are actually rates. So they will be outcome measures. There's sort of a mix of outcome measures and process measures in the recommendations that came from the National Quality Forum. And one thing that the committee was pretty sensitive to was they wanted to move forward with as many outcome measures as they could as quickly as they could, because there's a great interest in seeing not just process but outcomes.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Alberta Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one question about MRSA in particular. How are you or how will you be tracking and knowing that it's a hospital-acquired MRSA and not something they're admitted with or not something that happens in between discharge and readmission?
For the hospitals that are working on the project with us for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they report when a patient has symptoms of MRSA, and there are also lab tests that are done, so they can tell by the timing of the lab test whether they came in with the infection or they received it after they got in the hospital.
Following up on that same area, prior to my daughter being hospitalized for joint-related facial surgery last summer, I read up a lot about MRSA for other reasons too, because of legislative reasons. And I had the impression that, I mean, I think the number was, I could be totally wrong, but my memory is like 100 people are carriers of it, just naturally we have it in us already. And that I also had the impression that you could then arrive at the hospital as a carrier, and then you undergo major surgery, and then it flares it up in yourself, and the hospital doesn't really, you basically infected yourself following the surgery because you are a carrier. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but if so, that would lead us to take very different kinds of policy procedure actions. When I first became aware of that, I asked the surgeons involved about whether they ever recommend with joint surgeries and prosthetic surgery, you know, with these kinds of things, whether they test their patients in advance of the surgery, whether they're a carrier, because they might be higher risk post-surgery for infection if they are, or other precautions would need to take place. And there was a discussion about that issue. So to what extent is what I'm talking about actually an issue that is anticipated and being worked on?
Whoever. All right.
I'll try, and we'll have Michelle chime in if she'd like to add something. It's kind of a complicated area. Actually, we estimate that about 25% of us are carrying staph aureus in our nose. Okay. In parts of the country, there are maybe as many as 3% of children that may be carrying MRSA, mm-hmm. methicillin-resistant staph aureus, as opposed to MSSA.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is this different strain, which is a hospital-associated strain, and people who have underlying conditions, particularly people who are on dialysis, people who have been in hospital settings for a long time, long-term care facilities, a number of them may be carrying, these groups are high risk for carrying a hospital-associated strain of MRSA. There are some studies, this is an area under active investigation, there are some situations in which for certain procedures in certain medical facilities, they do screen their patients ahead of time, and if they are carrying staph, they, particularly MRSA, they give them some ointment in their nose right before the surgery and chlorhexidine wash to get rid of that carriage. That is not done universally. It is an area, as I say, of active investigation.
Part of our work with the Minnesota Department of Health was to review our MRSA recommendations, and one of the strategies that are evidence-based recommendations is to do a risk assessment of your population of patients that are coming into your hospital as well as patients that are coming in from the community. And so we study our MRSA incidence, and if it does occur in a population that has an implant, we do work with our surgeons in their clinics to recommend screening those patients. But if, like in my hospital, we have a program where we screen those patients before they come into surgery. And as Dr. Linfel said, we do treat them, but then we also do a cleansing product to decrease the microbial flora on their skin. And we look at the evidence to suggest that for other surgical procedures or in our intensive care unit patients, that type of thing. It's an evolving science, and so we continue to look to what we can do to prevent infection.
And President Lossler had a question. We have, you know, just about five more. This is not directed to you, but just so we can. Okay, President Lossler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and hopefully this will be brief, but I'm wondering, since so much of medical care now is a partnership between a hospital and a long-term care facility for rehab and for treating people who might be at risk or vulnerable to infections. Are we doing anything with the long-term care industry on this issue?
Maybe the Department of Health would. Or are you?
I can answer that.
We are very concerned about the long-term care population. It's a population that has a lot of underlying conditions, a population that's exposed to a lot of antibiotics, and so the potential for carriage of resistant organisms is high. Hospitals do know that patients who are coming in from a long-term care facility may be at higher risk for carriage with MRSA and other resistant organisms. If I have time, I would tell you about the two-tiered approach that the Minnesota Department of Health, along with the advisory committee, suggested to approach MRSA in acute care facilities. And as Michelle explained, each facility is supposed to evaluate their and assess their population that comes in, determine if they're having an issue with MRSA, determine which are the high-risk populations, and use that to come up with a plan, a more specific plan. So to answer you, number one, people are aware that the long-term care population is an issue. Depending on the facility and if they are having a situation with MRSA, they might screen those patients. Number two, there is now really a focus on taking a more holistic approach toward healthcare, understanding that it isn't just the acute care facility, but the acute care facility, it's long-term care facility, it's the clinic, dialysis center, surgical day center, everything is linked. And one of the areas that the Minnesota Department of Health is going to be working on is working harder on trying to assess the situation in long-term care facilities, trying to, as well as surgical care facilities and dialysis centers, trying to improve the infection control and get education messages out there so that we can not just wait for them to come into an acute care facility and have a problem with a resistant organism, but we can start handling it when people are in the community, at community healthcare settings.
Mr. George?
Yes. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jason George, and I am the legislative and political organizer for the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 49. Our local union is active and an active member of a large coalition of labor unions and consumer groups that have come together to work on health-related issues. The organization we formed, the Consumer Worker Coalition, represents hundreds of thousands of workers, consumers, and their families. I believe in your packet there's a one-page description of the group with a list of who is in it. I'm here today to testify on their behalf concerning the issue of hospital-acquired infections. You may be asking yourself why a construction labor union and consumer groups would be interested in a highly technical healthcare issue like HAI. To be blunt, as we sometimes are, our members and consumers in general are the ones getting sick and too often the ones dying. And as Representative Kahn pointed out, quite often paying too much for these infections as well. We are also, members of our coalition are the ones that do the work in the hospitals and are responsible for delivering care. So we feel it's our responsibility to participate in the efforts to prevent these infections, and we feel the consumers and workers can offer valuable input to help eliminate them. Infection reporting is a major part of the effort to eliminate HAI, and this committee and this legislature and Representative Kahn should be commended for passing a law that mandated such reporting. The hospitals, MDH, and APIC should also be commended for their efforts in passing this legislation and for the efforts to move quickly to make the information public. While we are pleased with these efforts and recognize that Minnesota enjoys a reputation as a leader in healthcare quality, there is room for improvement, as with anything. For example, there are 26 states that collect some kind of data on hospital-acquired infections, and 20 of them use the NISN, the National System for Center for Disease Control, National Healthcare Safety Network, as you heard about earlier. Minnesota does not use this system, and we think that we should. There are a number of reasons why this was not mandated in the original law. You've heard them earlier. But we are hopeful, as the Hospital Association is, that some of the technical issues that they talked about will be addressed very soon, and that we can move in that direction. The real obstacle, however, in our opinion, comes in the form of resources. The Department of Health and the hospitals do not have the resources necessary to implement the national system. If we're going to be serious about eliminating hospital-acquired infections, the legislature will need to provide funding for this transition. We might not have a choice. There are bills in Congress right now that are going to require all states to report infections and use the national system. So it's clear that on national front we're heading in that direction, so we're going to have to figure something out in that regard very soon. Another area that requires improved effort is the access to information on hospital-acquired infections. We need to increase promotional efforts. We need to do a better job getting this information in the hands of consumers. Studies have shown that 93% of consumers say that hospital infection rates would influence their decision-making in choosing where to have procedures done. If we get this information in their hands, people will use it. Consumer groups need to do a better job on this, hospitals and the Department of Health as well. We all do. Minnesota has made significant progress. Lastly, we feel that one other issue worth exploring is staffing levels in hospitals. As you've heard about today, there's been a number of layoffs of staff in hospitals, and this just adds to the problem of infection reporting and control as well. So we think we should take a look at that. Research shows that some infections are directly linked to staff levels and time spent on patients. Minnesota has made significant progress on hospital-acquired infections so far. Process measures were up on the Hospital Association website very quickly. The first of many surgical site procedures will be added in September, as you've heard. They're actively collecting more data starting very soon to add more measures to the website, which we think is a very good thing. We are also pleased that hospitals are following the national guidelines regarding what to report and how to collect the data. This information will help the public make better decisions in choosing a healthcare facility, and ultimately, we hope will create a competitive environment for hospitals to work towards lowering their infection rates. Increased resources to ensure time to complete policies and care related to infection reduction, monitoring, reporting, and reduction of infections in conjunction with greater promotion of information to consumers will help build on all of this progress. It is worth noting that consumers have been in part of Minnesota's reform efforts. In the past year, consumers have been invited by the hospitals to participate in the advisory group that has been responsible for overseeing the implementation of the reporting legislation. Consumer ideas have been respected and, in a number of cases, implemented. Consumer input has played a large role in making sure that information is understandable to the public. Easy comparisons can be made between hospitals, as we've seen, and that people can drill down even further to get, you know, more detailed information if they want it. We've also weighed in on discussions about what measures to collect and the best system for collecting them. Consumer involvement is worth pointing out because it doesn't work this way in every state. In too many cases, hospitals are reluctant to share the table with consumers. They're not interested in our input at all. Consumers are also sometimes too suspicious of the motives of hospitals and come to the conversation with negative stereotypes. All of this can lead to combative relationships between consumers and hospitals regarding hospital-acquired infections. We are proud to say that that is not the case in Minnesota. To their credit, the hospitals have welcomed our input and been open to our suggestions. We have a long tradition in the state of working together on tough issues, and we're happy to report that workers, consumers, and hospitals are carrying on that tradition, and we're working together on this thing to try to solve it. We are confident that the current structure, the advisory committee, and the work the MDH and the NHA and us, as well as us, are doing is working, and we commit to bringing our ideas and consumer worker perspectives to the table to help our state lower and ultimately eliminate hospital-acquired infections. Thank you for your time, and thank you for giving us this important hearing.
Thank you. And I think that we're going to have to move on. I'm sorry about that. But I do think that we got the information that we needed on what the status of this is. So I appreciate everybody pulling this all together. Thank you very much. And thanks, Representative Kahn. All right. So we're going to move on to the last subject of our hearing today, the electroconvulsive therapy treatment. And there is, some specific cases that have raised this issue. That's not really going to be the focus of this discussion today. but more kind of the general parameters around which this this type of therapy is ordered for people under civil commitment. So, Ms. Well, why don't we just start out? Roberta, yeah. Thank you. And we're going to, so it's 10 after 4, and if we can try to do this so we get out of here by 4 to 5, it would be great. I know we're running very long, but but we have a lot of people to get through.
Chairman Teese and members of the committee, my name is Roberta Opheim. I'm the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, and with me today I have Roger Schwab, who is a supervisor in our office over the Civil Commitment Training and Resource Center, and so we want to sort of provide some baseline level of information. If I may indulge for just a minute or two, I want to set the stage for what I think the conversation's about, and then Roger will go more into the detail of the actual process that he would train on and provide information on. In our office, the Office of Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, we neither support nor oppose ECT. That right is reserved to the individual patient. The practice of ECT is always applied against an individual patient, person, citizen who's in treatment. And I hope we don't lose sight of the fact that all of this discussion about efficacy and legal and all of that, it's all focused on a citizen member of Minnesota that's being discussed. So I hope we don't lose sight of that. This discussion specifically is about people under civil commitment. But in the future, we may want to talk about something beyond that scope, but we won't address that today.
Yeah, thank you.
The current discussion is about individuals under commitment who are required to have an invasive procedure against their will for their own good. It should always be about the right of the citizen to personal privacy, comprehensive and complete informed consent, a person's right to choose, and the due process of law. With few exceptions, in all other forms of medical care, adult citizens are allowed to decide to consent or refuse medical treatment, surgeries, and medications, even if it meant that without that care, the individual would die. This includes decisions of court-appointed guardians who must consider the wishes of the ward. Imagine how each of you might feel if you were put under anesthesia for electrical shock to your brain when you personally and passionately oppose the procedure. When individuals are forced against their will to do anything, they often lose faith and trust in their treatment providers. Some affected individuals refuse to seek help and treatment in the future out of fear for the coercive process that they might have to go through. In at least one case that I personally worked on, my client went to another state, made sure it was a non-interstate contact state, and waited out the length of his commitment and wouldn't come back to Minnesota until after. That shows the level of trauma that being forced against your will can have on an individual. Some of the clients later might say, thank you for the forced procedures, I feel better. But most of the ones that we talk to do not. They just feel like it's traumatizing and it shapes their future thinking. Civil commitment in Minnesota is usually for 6 months, which then may be extended for an additional 12 months. For a few people in Minnesota, when the client disability is severe or the system thinks they need a level of control, civil commitment can be done year after year after year, and so there are people who live for years under the veil of civil commitment. That does not mean they always live in the hospital. They live, you know, they may go into the hospital for an acute episode. That's dealt with, and they're put on a provisional discharge back into the community. But they're still under the legal veil of civil commitment. I think that, you know, provisional discharge is a series of conditions while you're under commitment that say you need to do the following things to take care of yourself or agree to certain treatments, unless, and if you don't, then we can revoke your provisional discharge and take you back into the hospital. It's not unlike the criminal justice system where someone gets on probation or parole, and if they violate it, they're taken back into the jail or prison. It's that kind of loss of liberty issue, except for under civil commitment, people who often don't follow through, it may be as a result of their disability, not necessarily willful choosing not to follow it. That provisional discharge brings us to the topic of ECP forced upon people who live in the community, which I think is a reflection of the evolution of our treatment and care system. During the past year, obviously, there was a high-profile case of an individual. But this brought into new questions into mind. Who monitors when a client isn't being seen in a hospital setting by a hospital treating psychiatrist? Who decides when the treatment should stop or resume? And this is only one case, but it's not the only case. Many clients do not know their rights, or they do not feel empowered to exercise their rights. This is whom this discussion is about. The Disability Law Center and the Consumer Survivor Network will be conducting a work group on this issue, and we certainly will be assertively participating in those discussions. Some of the unanswered questions from the Ombudsman's perspective, and I have no opinions on them, they're just questions, are forced versus voluntary, the side effects versus the efficacy of the treatment. Is the use of ECT increasing or decreasing? Should orders for ECT be time limited? What about the practice in nursing homes and other community settings when an individual does not have a guardian and they're not under civil commitment? Who decides their capacity to consent? Should the elements of the Price-Shepard court decision be codified in the same way that the Jarvis medication decision was later codified? Our systems of care change, and our laws need to change with them. But I hope for this discussion, we will never forget the individual human being citizen behind this entire discussion. With that, I will turn it over to Roger.
Thanks. Welcome. Mr. Chairman, committee members, I was asked to do a brief overview of the current process in Minnesota for getting consent for ECT. Currently, there are three different ways of doing that. The first one is if the individual has the ability or capacity to give informed consent, he or she may consent to that. But I need to point out there are really no laws for determining a person's ability to consent that are on statute. I do know the Department of Human Services has a rule and policies for determining consent, but that is specific to people in state institutions. It does not apply to the community settings that are being used more and more frequently now.
Just to clarify, so for informed consent, we have rules on the books for people in institutions, but not for people that are not in institutions. Okay.
I'm not sure that's the correct way of stating it.
Oh, okay. Is that correct, please?
I think the way to state that would be we have rules on the books for obtaining informed consent for neuroleptic medications, but not for ECT.
I see. I'm sorry. Okay.
Ultimately, again, it's the physician's decision as to whether or not that person has the ability to consent, ultimately. The next process would be if the individual has a guardian. The Uniform Probate Code powers of the guardian prohibit the guardian from consenting to ECT psychosurgery and forced sterilization. It requires a court hearing and court authorization for ECT. However, there are really no statutory standards for the court to use in making that decision. Most courts, however, do use the Price-Shepard standards that were set up years ago. If the person is a state ward, Department of Human Services guardianship has specific procedures that the county must follow, and the guardianship office works with the court as it's not a delegated authority that the counties can do, so they would request the Price-Shepard hearing. And then the last process is Price-Shepard itself. That was a Minnesota Supreme Court decision from 1976, so it's fairly old. It was never codified into statute, but the Jarvis decision was. There is disagreement on whether or not the decision applies only to state institutions or does it apply to people in community settings. Our agency's position is that it should apply to anyone who is on a commitment. The reason for that is that the Supreme Court's decision determined that it is a right to privacy, which includes individuals' rights to make personal choices. It also, at the time the decision was made back in 1976, people who were committed went to state hospitals. They didn't go anywhere else. Nowadays, we have community behavioral health hospitals. We have hospitals, private hospitals that we contract with for mental health treatment. The actual Price-Shepard decision stated that if the person is incompetent to give consent, the medical director of the state hospital must petition the county district court where the hospital is located for an order authorizing ECT. That's part of the reason people aren't clear on whether it can be used only at state facilities or in community settings. The court must appoint or shall appoint a guardian ad litem to represent the patient's interests. They have to have an adversarial proceeding where the court shall determine the necessity and reasonableness of the treatment. In doing so, the court must balance the patient's need for treatment against the intrusiveness of the treatment, and they set up six factors that the courts must follow. The first one is the extent and duration of changes in behavior patterns and the mental activity affected by the treatment, the risk of adverse side effects from the treatment, the experimental nature of the treatment, its acceptance in the medical community, the extent of intrusion into the patient's body and pain connected with the treatment, and the patient's ability to completely determine or competently determine for him or herself whether the treatment is deserved. So those are the current processes.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Representative Lockwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to our witnesses. I don't remember everything I once knew about Jarvis, but my understanding is it's a much more recent decision. And as I recall, it pretty much said people have the right to decide whether we think they're competent or not. As I recall, there's very limited circumstances in which they could be forced to undergo a certain medications without their permission. Is that correct? And has anyone tried to apply that legal thinking to this particular treatment?
Mr. Chair, committee members. Jarvis was decided at least 10 years later. It did determine that the use of neuroleptic medication, that was specific to neuroleptic medications, was an intrusive therapy and that it cannot be forced upon an individual, number one, absent a commitment, and number two, if the individual has capacity to give consent, they can't force it against the wishes. And if they do have capacity, then they have to have a court hearing, and the court needs to give authorization.
That wasn't as broad as I thought. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That's helpful. But some of those six factors, they're going to be the same for ECT every time, right? For every individual. So it's okay. So it's really coming down to that issue of whether they have the capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Ms. Holt? Dr. Holt, I guess. Okay. Welcome to the committee. And, you know, I'm sorry to about the short time, but if we could do it in about 5 minutes,
sure.
Try. Thanks. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Allison Holtz. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist. I have a private practice, and I also do ECT at Abbott Northwestern Hospital. I was asked to present to you just the basics of ECT to give you an understanding of what happens during ECT, who gets it, and what the side effects are. On my front page, I put, yes, we still do that, because every time I go to a party, I don't go to very many of them, but I always get asked, what do you do? I'm a psychiatrist. I do ECT. You still do that. So, yes, we do still do that. It is called shock treatment by some. It's been used for over 60 years. It's extremely safe and very effective treatment for certain psychiatric disorders. It's only indicated for some psychiatric disorders. The way we do it is a small amount of electricity is applied to the scalp, and that causes a seizure inside the patient's brain. The procedure is painless because the patient is placed under general anesthesia. And typically they don't have memory of the event, just like they wouldn't have memory of a regular seizure. In the U.S., approximately 100,000 individuals are receiving ECT each year. And ECT is most commonly given to patients with severe depression, mania in bipolar disorder, or manic depressive disorder, and schizophrenia. ECT is often given when medications are ineffective or when other treatments are less safe or difficult to tolerate. So many of our medications have a lot of side effects, and sedation, weight gain, high cholesterol. If patients can't tolerate that, then they might choose ECT. Or a pregnant woman who has bipolar disorder would need a mood stabilizer. And in the first 3 months of her pregnancy is when the brain and the spinal cord and the heart is being developed. And so during that time, there are certain medications, mainly mood stabilizers, that we would not want to use on a patient who's pregnant. So in that case, pregnancy is indicated, an indication for pregnancy with a mental disorder, an indication for treatment with ECT. And then certain medical and psychiatric complications, which make it particularly important that the patients recover quickly and fully. Say a woman has had a baby and she has a psychotic depression, mm-hmm. and we want to get her out of the hospital as quickly as possible. She wants to get home so that she can mother her new child. We would think about using ECT rather than using a medication that may take 3 weeks to have her fully recover or even start to recover. Or a catatonic person who comes into the hospital and has stopped eating, doesn't move, sits in postures, and so when you do that for a long period of time, you break down muscle, which ruins your kidneys, and you get malnourished, and so that person, we would consider that a life-threatening or a serious event that we would consider ECT, or if the patient has responded well to ECT in the past. On the ECT team is a psychiatrist who's has expertise in ECT, psychiatric nurses, and an anesthesiologist, and it's administered in a dedicated suite. For ECT, just like if you get a colonoscopy, it's in a dedicated area of the hospital. There's a waiting room, the treatment room, and a recovery room, all of which have monitors to monitor blood pressure, heart, how the heart's beating, and oxygen. To do ECT, first we give a very thorough medical exam by an internist or primary care physician. And if there are any worrisome issues, we may refer them on to a specialist. Once we are satisfied that it's safe to give ECT,
Then we usually give ECT three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, for the index course. During the treatment, we start an IV line. We put leads on the head for an EEG, which monitors brain waves. We put leads on the chest, which monitors heart rhythm. And then we monitor blood pressure and blood oxygen. We give an anesthetic through the IV to relax the person and make them fall asleep. It's general anesthetic. And then we give them a relaxant for their muscles so that they don't actually convulse during the treatment. Most patients lay still or relatively still during the treatment. I apply a brief electrical charge to their scalp, and they have a seizure. The patient has a seizure for usually 20 to 60 minutes. If it goes longer than that, I can give them a minute, or 60 seconds, sorry. 1 minute. I saw her face. I must have said something wrong. I give a medication if it goes longer than that so that we stop the seizure immediately. The patient's then taken through to the recovery room and is in there for 30 to 60 minutes. We usually give 6 to 12 treatments total for an index course, and then some patients elect to start a maintenance course where they would get it once a week, twice a month, once a month, and continue on that indefinitely. Some people just stop it and start back on medications and recover very well. It's estimated that 1 in 10,000 patient deaths are attributable to ECT, so it's not without risk, just like any procedure or any medication that we give. What I'd like you to keep in mind is that their illnesses are not without risk also. ECT appears to have less risk of death or serious medical complications than some of the medications that we use in for psychiatric illness or for any kind of medical illness. Common side effects include confusion within 1 hour of the treatment, headaches, nausea, both of which we can treat with medications. Cardiac complications often happen during the treatment or right after, but are very transient. Memory loss is what most patients complain about and worry about. You can have a rapid loss or a rapid forgetting of new information, so that, let's say a person had ECT and then right 2 hours later I said, let's meet next tomorrow at 2 o'clock. They would likely not, or they could possibly not remember that. Or a loss of memory for past events, so 4 events in their life, which is troublesome for, I mean, you can imagine. It can be troublesome. Shortly after ECT, most patients show improved test scores on intelligence, attention, and learning, though, because mental illness itself also causes problems in concentration, memory. We have something called, there's something called pseudo-dementia, which is depression in a person who is actually not demented, but it's depression so severe that they look demented. They can't concentrate, they can't remember. And studies in animals have shown no evidence of brain damage from brief seizures like ECT. In the adult, seizures must continue for hours before brain damage can occur. Mm-hmm. Brain scans have shown no injury to the brain. There's been a lot of research on that. There's a lot of literature to support that. The benefits of ECT depend on having a seizure, so that's important, and then how we produce the seizure, where I put the leads can make a big difference. And the seizure produces biological changes in the brain that I won't go into, but that's how it works. Release of neurotransmitters, release of different proteins, and there's still a lot of research in this area. What I want to make clear is it's not used to control or punish. It's most movies do not represent ECT in any way, shape, or form of how it is today. I don't know how it was in the back then, back when Once Over the Cuckoo's Nest was supposed to take place, but today that's not how it is. Patients from one study said that ECT was no worse than going to the dentist. However, I don't like going to the dentist, so I don't know what that really says, but I mean, I think it's positive. ECT, so in a nutshell, ECT is a relatively safe procedure to treat very serious illnesses with serious morbidity and mortality, and generally we do not consider ECT unless that's the case.
It's not used for control or punishment. It's only done in centers which are equipped to handle emergencies and the complications of ECT, and it's an incredibly effective treatment. I didn't mention this already. I meant to. The rates of remission are 50 to 90%, and I won't go into what puts you in the 50% camp or what puts you in the 80 to 90% camp, but just consider that range. It's very effective in medicine in general. That's a very high effectiveness rate. In psychiatry, it is also. Mm-hmm. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Just a quick question. Thank you. I recently had a patient who had just once for ECT, and I hadn't seen that since training at Golden Valley. So I'm curious, Abbott does it. Are there a number of centers in Minnesota that do mm-hmm. it? And how do we rate as far as other states? Do you know?
I don't know how. Oh, sorry. Mr. Chairman.
Oh, no. Go ahead. That's all right.
I don't know how we rate in terms of other states. Maybe Dr. Radke can address that, or Dr. Sulik. We do it at Mercy, Abbott, United in St. Paul, North Memorial, and then some outstate places, St. Peter, of course.
And you're, what percentage of your patients, is it all voluntary?
No, I do have some committed patients that I see.
Okay, and do we have any idea of the number of involuntary?
It's a very, very small part of my practice. So I do probably 20 to 25 ECTs each week, and I would say one max is at Abbott is under Price Shepherd.
Okay, thank you.
I just want to ask about the VA. Are they doing? Do they do?
Oh yes, yeah. They do it at the VA.
Okay.
In Minneapolis, I don't know about St. Cloud. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. This has been really that's really helpful. I appreciate it. Dr. Sulik, and I don't know if Dr. Radke is coming down with you. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee.
Chair members of the committee, Dr. Reed Sulik, Assistant Commissioner for the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration of the Department of Human Services. With me, I have Dr. Alan Radke, who is the Chief Medical Officer for State Operative Services, who is going to walk you through the presentation, probably for two very important reasons. One, he talks so much faster than I do. And second, he is much more aware of the history of and the rules and policies and procedures in Minnesota that I think you're most interested in hearing. So I've asked him to walk us through that today.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, committee members, what we want to focus on is what we do in state operative services. So this only is state operative services. I want to make sure that you understand we're not talking about anything that's happening outside state operative services.
And just to clarify, that includes people that are institutionalized and also these people under civil commitment that are in the community?
No.
This is just within state operated services in the buildings.
It's in our Okemet Regional Treatment Center.
Right. Okay.
State operated forensic services. Those are what we're going to be talking about.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. We administer ECT according to the Minnesota rules, the Price-Shepherd decision, the Kinzer decision, and a policy that we were required to develop, Policy 6290. What happens if you look at our rules? Our rules require that we follow the determination of whether ECT is necessary and whether or not we can obtain consent. So, the medical director of a facility, in consultation with the patient's treating physician, must determine that ECT is medically indicated. Now, the only time ECT can be administered in state-operated services is under the four conditions. The court order must be in place, or a court-appointed guardian has been given authorization following a court review. Now, this is very important. The law in the state of Minnesota requires, the guardianship law does not permit a guardian to consent to ECT without a court review. A proxy representing the patient may give a consent for ECT if there is a valid advance directive permitting ECT, or the person has the capacity to give informed consent and does give written informed consent. Okay. Now the rule goes on further and instructs the medical director of the state facility what needs to be reviewed to give the medical indication, and these are the six things. There's a therapeutic effect expected from the treatment, that the risk and potential benefits have been weighed, that there's a likelihood that the desired effect will be reached, that alternatives have been considered prior to considering ECT, that the community standard is being followed for the use of ECT, and that the patient has capacity to give informed consent, or we have pursued the court order.
So, just to clarify, you have to have one of these first four conditions in the previous slide, and then there's analysis on using these factors?
Right. The analysis actually has to occur before we have a request for ECT,
okay.
Even if we're going to do a request of the individual who has the capacity to give informed consent.
Okay. Thank you.
So, the judicial authorization required is also specified in the rule. Here, the state medical director or the state facility medical director or designee has to petition the court. Now, if it's a guardian, the guardian has to seek authority from the court before consenting to ECT. And what is weighed is that the necessary and appropriateness of ECT in terms of the individual's welfare. A petition is then filed in the court, in the county of the where the court is being held, and the petition has specific things that need to be said. Needs to talk about the purpose of the ECT, needs to talk about the risk and effects of the procedure, needs to talk about the findings of the medical director and the treating physician, and it may request the appointment of a guardian ad litem. Now, we are also under Price Shepherd. Price Shepherd, as the Ombudsman Office was speaking to, is not codified. It is a Supreme Court decision. That decision was laid down in 1976 when a mother of a patient at Minnesota Security Hospital filed charges against the medical director of the hospital for assault and battery and violation of civil rights. The court was very specific in what they said. They said that the patient who had failed to respond to other forms of treatment, given ECT, was not cruel and unusual punishment. And the medical director had acted in good faith and without the knowledge that he had possibly violated the individual's constitutional rights, and therefore was immune from liability under federal civil rights acts, as well as immune from tort liability. But the court went on to say more, said in the future, the state must adopt procedures, obtain court approval to apply intrusive forms of treatment, and include ECT as one of the first, include intrusive forms of treatment. Now, following up the Price Shepherd in 1985, we have the Kinzer decision, another Supreme Court decision, not codified. And this decision was made when Mr. John Kinzer appealed two orders from Nicollet County Court authorizing the administration of ECT at Minnesota Security Hospital. The court said we have to clarify the venue for an ECT hearing by saying it could either be in the court of commitment or in the court where the hospital is located. It went on to say that orders to see ECT must also contain reasonable time limits. Now, as we have heard about the way we do ECT, in the state of Minnesota, in state-operated services, when we request ECT for a major depressive episode, we usually request 8 to 12 in the series. When we're talking about a manic psychosis or a psychotic disorder due to schizophrenia, we may ask for 16 to 20. Then we also may ask if we think it would be a benefit for the continuation of ECT on a maintenance basis. And then we specify one time a week, two times a month, one time a month, depending upon how the patient has historically responded to ECT. It also required by the Kinzer decision that medical necessity be present at the time that the ECT order was written. So if the person was psychiatrically stable, we could not request a Price Shepherd.
Okay. And we need to wrap up in about 1 minute.
Okay. The 6290 policy follows the Price Shepherd, is based on law, rule, and the decision. It applies to all state-operated services, and it ensures that either we have a written informed consent or a court order for the administration of ECT. We know that there were 732 individuals who received ECT in calendar year 2008 under the Minnesota Healthcare Program. In state-operated services, we administered ECT in two sites, Milkomet Regional Treatment Center and Security Hospital. At the Milkomet Regional Treatment Center, the people go to Mercy Hospital for the ECT treatment. Presently, we're treating 3 patients. Over the fiscal year of 2009, we treated 22 patients under court authorization. All the patients were committed, and all were court-authorized under Price Shepherd. Minnesota Security Hospital, it's administered at Security Hospital. 3 patients had ECT, and 8 received authorized ECT treatment in fiscal year 2009. That represents 0.8% of the total individuals receiving ECT paid by the mental health care program. And then, you know, outside of the mental health care program, the Minnesota health care program, there's a number of the people that are receiving ECT under their own insurance. Thank you. Any questions?
I don't think so. Thank you very much. That's helpful. Yeah. I don't know how Louise and the come on up. However you want to proceed. So it's Louise and Barb King. So, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we have we're
members of the committee. Yeah.
Yes. So, and as quickly as possible, I don't want to, you know, We listen. I understand. Thank you.
I have a message from Raymond Sanford, who was just got off the list for ECT. He's had 40 of them, and a member of Mind Freedom went over to his place and got this statement from him yesterday. He says, after having over 40 ECT treatments and having many ill effects, I now feel much better. I no longer am bothered by severe shaking hands, and my memory is improving. It is wonderful not to dread the approach of Wednesday and the hateful prep time. I feel I can live a more normal life. Having ECT was one of the most traumatic times of my life. That was Ray Sanford. Now, I had ECT in 1955. The reason was because I had 4 kids under age 5 and didn't get out. But I wasn't a conservator for a young man in 2003 because they couldn't find anybody else to be conservator, and I brought my Odatus and machine that they take for to get the smoke out. I got the police gas out of his house, and anyway, they took away I wouldn't sign for him to get shock treatments. He was in St. Peter State Hospital, although he was never a mild man, he was never violence, but he had this Nicolong kind of a friend. And so when I wouldn't sign for him to get the shock treatment, they took away my conservatorship and gave it to another somebody else. And right away he was given shock treatment. That was in 03. He died in April. I don't know that anything did any good for him. There is one thing. Health and Human Services accounts for 27% of the state budget. One thing we can do is to eliminate the part of the state budget that is continually disabling some people and making them sicker for longer, many times for life. They are neighbors of you and me. Keeping them on drugs and thus disabled doesn't serve any good purpose. Minnesota does not let anybody out of the system anymore. I was railroaded into the system and was locked up, drugged, and shocked. And they let me off drugs before I was allowed to go home. We don't let anyone out anymore. We are continually adding to the numbers of disabled people who need care. Why is that? Follow the money. The pharmaceutical companies are the only ones who don't have to negotiate with the government how much they can charge. The insurance companies pay whatever the medical pharmaceutical hospital system submits and charges. The prescribed drugs cause delusions and hallucinations, weight gain of 60 to 100 pounds, suicidal thoughts and actions, incontinence, and diabetes. Is there any reason to prescribe, even force these drugs on people who are mixed up in the first place? There is no science in the mental health system. We can change that. Yes, I know you'd say that those people don't count. And so, is that any reason to pretend they deserve to be locked up, drugged up, and dumbed down? And is there any reason to extend the debt to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren to bring great wealth to people we don't children and great-grandchildren to bring great wealth to people we don't know? We could balance the budget if we would just use science instead of greed in dealing with these. We could treat people humanely. They are the least of God's creatures, and they deserve no less. Involuntary commitment and forced drugging are the path of least resistance when society is faced with someone who is disturbing and their thinking does not conform to society's norms. We could choose to spend time with them to develop a therapeutic relationship and thus be able to engage the person with voluntary, humane alternatives leading to recovery. Hardly any of the civil commitments I have observed in the last 23 years of my advocacy have been legally justified. We have a tremendous opportunity to encourage the creation of voluntary, recovery-oriented services. In order to be successful, various myths of mental illness need to be debunked among the general public. Humane, effective, recovery-oriented, non-coercive treatments need to be instituted. We have seen in a number of people who have recovered through functional medicine, nutritional medicine, holistic health, by tapering off the destructive drugs while recovering the body through the use of nutritious food, vitamins, and supplements. Oh yes, and the Quakers in the 1800s found that people recovered through friendliness and caring. This is absent in most of the treatments facilities. This is especially so in the four-person housing plus services set up when the numbers of, quote, mentally ill people kept locked up and drugs overran the group home system. The courts seem to have forgotten about due process, the meaning of which has been clear for more than a century. Parties whose rights are to be affected are entitled to be heard. This is violated every day in Minnesota courts, at least in Hennepin County and Ramsey County, where I know because I have monitored them.
And just to focus in back, to the extent you can, on the ECT part of it.
Yes, and it is a mistake to appoint guardians when somebody refuses the drugs or the ECT.
Okay, well, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. And
Ms. King?
Sir, I won't take up much of your time. All I have to say is the whole mental health, all these hospitals with mental health, you need to clean it up, because you, any of you,
if you have a conscience, if you only knew the things that go on in these institutions, these hospitals, mental health, whether they're railroaded, whether they're very sick, whatever they are, the abuse, the mental assaults that go on, it's a nightmare. You have to do something. You have to look into it. You got to do it, because I don't know how anyone can go home and live with a conscience knowing the things that are going on. It's very, very shocking. I have nothing to say, but the whole system needs to be cleaned up, because it is big time money that is being spent, and lives are being... Human life is a very, very sacred, very, very sacred. And whether it's sick or railroaded or whatever it is, it's very sad. It's a nightmare what's going on. That's all I have to say. I hope you can look into it.
And it's not necessary we can use the other alternative cares, holistic health, recover people.
There's a lot of people that need to be in these hospitals and need to get help that aren't getting it. And there's just a lot of things that it needs to be cleaned up. It's a very, very costly what's going on. And
well, and I appreciate that, and we are going, thank you for coming down, and you know, we do have some groups working on it.
If there's anything you want to know, and you have any questions, and if I can help you, you can let me know.
Yeah, thank you.
If you have any certain questions, and thank you for letting me speak.
Absolutely, thank you. All right, we just have two more, welcome. Yes, please go ahead. We're almost done here. Yeah, you can go ahead too if you. Well, she's not signed up. Okay.
I have a handout.
Yeah. Okay, there's a handout.
Actually, I'm the last person.
You're the last person. Excellent.
So Rorick had to leave for another meeting.
All right. Sorry about that.
I'm here in her stead. My name is Patricia Sievers. I'm from the Minnesota Disability Law Center, where I'm an attorney. The Disability Law Center is a federal protection and advocacy program for people with disabilities in Minnesota, and we represent individuals in the areas of abuse, neglect, and protection of rights. Particularly given the recent attention that to ECT, and especially involuntary ECT, and the publicity around that, the Disability Law Center decided that now is a particularly good time to take a look at the current state of ECT in Minnesota, especially involuntary ECT. And as people have noted, the Price-Shepard case dates back to 1976, which predates our most recent Commitment Act in 1982. So it's a good idea to take a look at that. So we've done two things. First, thanks to our hardworking law clerks, we are putting together a survey of the law in Minnesota and nationally, and we're in the process of finalizing that review for a work group that I'm going to mention in a minute. What you've gotten is a summary of that review, and some of the pieces of that have been gone through by the Ombudsman's Office and Dr. Radke, so I won't dwell on that. I do want to show you a map, however, that sort of indicates the broad categories that states use in addressing ECT. Minnesota is in the orange group, which requires, there are 17 states that require a court order for the administration of ECT, and there's another 5 that have specifically time-limited court orders, which Minnesota does not. Those are the red ones. We think that
that's an issue that does need to, that's one example of an issue that needs to be looked at, is time limits. Our state has requires a court hearing, but since nothing has been codified, there's a lot of murkiness on what should be the limits in court orders for ECT. Generally, they follow the neuroleptic process, which follows the Commitment Act. So if you've been committed for 6 months, you might find that the duration of your ECT order is for 6 months. Dr. Holt testified that generally, typically, ECT is 6 to 12 sessions, which is more like 1 month. So we think one of the things that needs to be looked at is specific time limits for ECT. Another area where that's an important issue is in guardianship, where guardians are authorized to agree to ECT, but there aren't any provisions or time limits set for guardians as well. So we think that this is one issue that they're looking at.
Are you coming back with a proposal?
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth. We have a work group which is, will be starting meeting in early September. That work group includes consumers, advocates, clinicians, and attorneys, and hopefully bureaucrats as well. And we hope to come back if you'd like us to. Our recommendations, we hope, will be finalized by the end of November, and we are more than happy to come back before this body if you would like.
Okay, well, that's helpful. And I have a feeling if we do that, we'll want to include Representative Mulready's committee as well, because it sounds like it's as much that type of a legal issue as this. But we appreciate you coming down. Thank you, and thanks for doing the work, going ahead and getting it.
Any questions at this late hour?
I don't see any. And we're an hour over at this point. So thank you. And
thank you.
We're going to have our next hearing on October 5th. I appreciate everybody's patience. We're trying to fit as much in, and so we don't have to pay multiple per diems here. So that's so. But thanks for everybody's patience, and we'll be adjourned.